Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out and a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. Feel all right. I feel all right tonight. And I bring you precious contraband.
All right, everybody. Good morning. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we are here until 5 a.m. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday.
Yeah, 2 for Tuesday.
Yeah. It's one artist, two songs. Get your request in now. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Good morning, everybody. Hey, listen, coming up in just a few minutes, Lindsey Cochran and Richard Pettengill are going to join us live in studio. They are with Great Moments in Vinyl. Great Moments in Vinyl is a group of incredible musicians organized by Lindsey Cochran who get together and play and pay tribute to some of the best albums of all time and some of the best musical artists of all time. A very, very special show coming up on July 25th. They will be playing at the Rialto Square Theater, beautiful Rialto Square Theater in Joliet, and they will be playing the music of Woodstock on the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, and it's July 25th. So all of the incredible artists that played over that festival, they're going to be playing a bunch of songs from the Festival of Woodstock. And on top of that, Richard Pettengill, who plays guitar in Great Moments in Vinyl, was at Woodstock. He was 15 years old, so we are going to hear some firsthand stories about what it was like to actually be at that historic music festival 50 years ago. So Richard's going to tell us all kinds of stories about that, some firsthand Woodstock stories. So it's going to be great. So they're coming up. Also, it is, we're celebrating the music of 1969, so 50 years ago, some of the best albums of all time. We're going to talk about the 30 best albums of 1969. According to Paste magazine. And also, some people didn't get famous until after they were 40. And we're going to talk about those A-listers who didn't really actually hit their stride until they hit their 40s. So that's all coming up right here. And again, 2 for Tuesday requests, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can also contact us there for talk or text anytime you want to jump in. And also, you can follow us on Twitter. At Nick D Show, Twitter at Nick D Show, and of course Facebook, which is facebook.com/Nick D Show. So you know what, you should subscribe to our podcasts. Our podcasts are free. They're very popular, and we thank you for that. It's a great way to listen if you're not up between 1 and 5 a.m. during the weekdays. You can listen anytime you want, and so go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe. It's free. They will be automatically sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So that's what's coming up on the show. We want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. If we get to another topic that we were going to get to last night, we didn't have time, or yesterday morning, we didn't have time. And we're also going to talk a little bit about hidden treasures that were actually worth nothing. So lots of stuff coming up on the show, mostly celebrating the year of 1969, talking about Woodstock, talking about the best albums of 69 as well. 312-981-7200, phone number for talk and text, and your 2 for Tuesday requests. My producer is Tom Hush. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how's it going, Nick?
All right, how are you, man?
Not too bad, not too bad.
Looking forward to talking about Woodstock.
Yes.
Richard Pettengill was there.
I can't imagine what that must be like.
And he's seen like a million amazing concerts. And we'll talk about that as well. He's a fascinating guy and a tremendous musician and a great guitarist. And Lindsey Cochran, obviously, is awesome. We love Great Moments in Vinyl. And they'll be playing the music of Woodstock at the Rialto Square Theater on July 25th. So we got that. And we'll get the 2 for Tuesday requests. You'll be getting those. And so, yeah, there you go. So Cubs blew it.
Yeah.
Strope, Pedro Strope.
I don't know what I expected out of Strope, really.
Yeah. Well, it was, I mean, that was just, it was ridiculous. They were up 4-2. They lost 5-4.
Should have been in the bag.
Yeah, should have. Wasn't, though. So, anyway. Let's go into the newsroom. It's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Hey, morning, sir.
How are you, man?
Pretty darn good.
All right. Very cool. By the way, you know, we're going to be talking about the 30 best albums of 1969.
Oh, man, there's so many.
And maybe you'll get some inspiration out of that.
I'm sure I will, yeah.
And by the way, for those people who don't know, Vic is on a musical journey right now, and he's been listening to all of the top 100 albums of all time, according to Rolling Stone, because, Vic, as you've said yourself, your musical knowledge was kind of non-existent.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And so you wanted to change that.
So many of them are at late 60s and early 70s.
Too. Yeah. Absolutely.
So many, like 80%.
So we're going to double up because we haven't done it in a couple of weeks on Vic's Picks. Every Friday morning on Vic's Picks, we do it at 3:30. And Vic talks about albums that he's been listening to and what he loves about them, what he learned about them as he goes on this musical journey. And so this week, Vic, we got to play catch up.
Yeah, and I thank you for that. I look forward to it.
Yeah, so we'll start it at 3. We usually start it at 3:30. We'll start it at 3, and you can talk about all the albums that you've been listening to. What number are you up to now?
27 or so.
Wow. Yeah,
and I think by the time we do this show, we should be in the top 25, I think, by the next time.
By the next time you do it. Wow, yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That is unbelievable.
It's been a journey. It really has.
Yeah.
I know, it's just music. Oh, it's been a journey. You know, listen to 100 albums that are all considered great by a vast majority of people. It's life-changing, really. I mean, in 2 months, it's really been cool.
Yeah, no, it's great. And we actually absolutely enjoy talking to you about that, too. So
well, I thank you, man. Yeah. That's really cool for having me on.
All right, so that's Vic. He's in the newsroom, and Tom is producing. Tom, have you seen the movie Woodstock?
I've seen select performances.
Yeah.
You know, like, because they're all available on YouTube or something. Personally, my favorite is Santana when they do Soul Sacrifice, because mm-hmm. that is just totally out there, great jam, and I love watching that again and again. But all the stuff of Hendrix and little Sha-na-na, if I'm
Sha-na-na. Everybody forgets that Sha-na-na was a part of that show. Well, the movie, it was directed by Michael Wadley, directed the documentary Woodstock, and there's two versions of it. There was the theatrical release, and then there was the director's cut, which is almost 4 hours long. And I remember the Music Box showed it a bunch of years ago, and my friends and I went, and it was really long.
I mean, 4 hours of watching music, that's a long time, even if you're there, even if you were physically there.
It's long, one of the things about that movie is that it became a classic. Obviously, the soundtrack with the very iconic picture of the couple in the wrapped in the blanket. Standing amongst the crowd is one of the most iconic album covers of all time and one of the most iconic pictures of all time. Lots of historical stuff happened at that Woodstock. So we're going to talk about it from first hand. Richard Pettengill, he was 15 years old when he went, which is just, I mean, I can't even imagine being a 15-year-old at Woodstock.
The closest I came to Woodstock was at 15, was Tinley Park.
Yeah.
That's about as good as it got for me.
Tinley Park. Oh, yeah. Now, what do they call that place now?
Oh,
is it the Hollywood Casino Village?
It's something amphitheater. I can't even remember. I think it changed even from when I went.
Yeah. Well, it used to be
10 years ago.
It used to be the World Music, and then it was the Twitter Center.
The Tweeter?
Tweeter. Twitter. Yeah, Tweeter. Tweeter Center. And I don't know what it is now. I think it's the Hollywood Casino Village or something.
Yeah,
along those lines.
Totally different situation.
But Michael, the interesting thing about the director, the guy who directed Woodstock, do you know he directed a horror film?
What was that?
Wolfen.
Wolfen?
Wolfen.
Wilfen.
No, Wolfen.
Wolfen, like
Wolfen.
Like I'm Wolfen.
It's a werewolf movie with Albert Finney, and it's really good. I'm not kidding. It's really good.
Yeah,
1981, Wolfen. It was weird because like he was a documentary filmmaker and then all of a sudden he makes this werewolf movie and it turns out to be really good. And I don't know if it's available. Maybe it's not even available anymore. I had it on VHS. I saw it in the theater like a couple of times. It's a really, really cool movie. Is it available?
Well, I'm looking to see if you can get it. You can definitely get it on Amazon and Google Play and
stuff
like that.
Oh, so it's available then.
And it's I guess it's playing on Encore. If you have the movie channels.
Oh, wow. I have Encore. All right, cool. I'll have to check that out.
Well, you can watch it on Thursday at 9:35 p.m.
Good. I'll set my DVR. I loved that movie. Albert Finney, too, man. The king.
Edward James Olmos?
Yeah.
Gregory
Hines? Yeah, no, it's a good movie, man.
Oh,
it's a good movie. It's a great werewolf movie, really is. Wolfen. So, all right, listen, let's break because we got Lindsey Cochran and Richard Pettengill, and they are in the PPG Paints green room, the beautiful, wonderful PPG Paints green room, and we'll bring those guys in. We're going to talk all things Woodstock. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Tuesday morning. That means two for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. One artist, two songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. A little bit later on, in honor of... we're celebrating a lot of 50th anniversaries. Just this past weekend, obviously, Saturday was the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. And 1969 was a pretty interesting year, so we're also just going to be talking about Woodstock here in a couple of seconds, and then a little bit later on, we're going to talk about the 30 best albums of 1969, and some people didn't get famous till after 40, so we're going to talk about some A-listers who didn't hit their stride till after 40. But we were just listening to some music there that you heard from Woodstock, and I want to welcome the folks over at Great Moments in Vinyl. Lindsey Cochran puts this together. And they do gigs pretty frequently. And we want to welcome two people from Great Moments in Vinyl. They've been on the show many times, Lindsey Cochran and Richard Pettengill. And guys, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Richard, I haven't seen you in a long time.
Yeah, it's good to be back,
yeah,
Nick.
It's great. Great to see you guys. So tell, as we always do, tell everybody about Great Moments in Vinyl. Lindsey?
We're just a bunch of music fans. We like to pick an album. Usually it's an album. Sometimes we'll do something a little off the beaten track, like this Woodstock show. But
yeah,
we pick an album of music, maybe two albums by an artist, and put it together on a stage. And the whole point is not for us to be there to say, hey, look at us, look how cool we are. It's more like, wasn't this a great album?
Yeah.
Didn't you enjoy it too? So that's what we're all about. So for the Woodstock show, we thought, well, we don't want to do the Woodstock album. I mean, do we really need to remember Sha-na-na? I'm not sure. So what we did is went through the set list of the Woodstock show, and bands like Sweetwater and Quill and Incredible String Band, they didn't make the cut, but we picked songs from Janis Joplin, as you heard, Santana, The Who, Jimi Hendrix, of course, and some of the early stuff, some of the acoustic stuff at the beginning of the show, Richie Havens.
Oh, Richie Havens.
Burt Summer, a name you never hear, yeah, but an amazing version of Simon Garfunkel's America at Woodstock. So that's part of our set.
That's great.
As well.
That's really, really great. How long has Great Moments in Vinyl been around now?
Oh, dear. 6 years? Starting our seventh year in August.
And
so
I think you guys have come in pretty much regularly on this show since then, right?
Thank you so much for
since
that.
Since the beginning?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, once we got the foot in the door on the Nick DiGilio show, we said, oh, we like talking to him. We'll go back and do that again.
Well, that's really...
Because we do.
We love having you guys on.
Well, you're a music fan.
Yes, I am.
You know, you get it.
I am. So, Woodstock. Now, the thing is, Richard Pettengill, who is with us, first of all, when did you start playing?
I started playing guitar at the age of 13. Mm-hmm. I got my first Fender guitar at that point. I said to my dad, I need an electric guitar. I need to learn guitar. So he took me shopping. We got myself a Fender Mustang.
Mustang, yes.
Which, you know, was not a cool guitar until Kurt Cobain picked
right,
one up.
It was like,
I made a
Head
mistake.
Of your time.
I made the mistake of getting a Mustang. Should have held out for a Strat. Of course, I could probably retire now if I'd held on to that Strat.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's where you started. Was it the music that you were listening to that inspired you to pick up the guitar?
Yeah, I was listening to a lot of very cool guitar players, especially like Mike Bloomfield was an early like inspiration. And so I sat down, I just tried to play what he was playing.
Yeah.
Just by ear.
Yeah.
And John Fogerty too.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, Lindsey, what about you? You started playing music at what age?
Oh, well, see, I never answer the question directly, do I? I would say junior high, because they had a band program. And that's how I started.
High school band?
Junior high.
Junior high band, yeah.
So middle school, I guess you would say, in Illinois. So seventh grade, picking up the trombone, of all things, which was because Chicago was popular back then.
Right.
So, and I guess I like Jethro Tull, too, but, you know, somehow the flute seemed a little too much trombone, let's just move the slide, you know, just put it here, put it there, and away you go. So that's what I started on. Mm-hmm. Got into the music program at the school and learned how to read music and how what chords, how the, you put those together, and just went off from there.
Yeah.
Started making music.
You know, you mentioned Jethro Tull, you mentioned the flute. Nobody but Ian Anderson plays flute in rock and roll, right? I mean, he's the only guy.
Well, there's a guy in Blues Project, was it?
There was one song called Flute Thing by the Blues Project.
Uh-huh. An odd little band called Sea Train, I think, had a flute. Well, in Blood, Sweat, and Tears, one of the guys in that band played the flute. But you're right.
I mean, as far as front men go.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, as far as performers like Ian Anderson.
Yeah, well, and Ian Anderson is one of the greatest front men ever.
Absolutely.
He's unbelievably entertaining.
We were just talking about Tull in the car. We should do a Jethro Tull show.
Oh, sometime. I love Jethro Tull, man. Who are you going to get for the flute?
Probably the bar owner at Martyrs, because he plays flute very well.
Is that right?
Ray Quinn is really good on flute.
Is that right?
He books Martin Barr on a regular basis there.
Oh, man.
You know, Tull guitarist. And you could come and tell stories with me.
I saw Jethro Tull, like four or five times, I think. And I remember I saw him in 76 or 77 at the stadium.
Songs from the Wood?
It was probably Songs from the Wood. Yeah, it probably was Songs from the Wood.
Or Heavy Horses.
I think it was Songs from the Wood.
Yeah.
And then I saw him, it was funny, but actually the show that I went to, this specific show that I'm talking about, 76 or 77, whichever year it was, somebody whipped a bottle on stage.
Oh.
Somebody threw a bottle on stage, and it shattered in front of Ian Anderson.
Whoa.
And he said, and he stopped, you know, the song, they stopped the song, and he said, "We're not going to play again until that blank gets kicked out." And he pointed up to the balcony, and it was on the right side of the balcony. It was first balcony, I think.
Wow.
And so the spotlight guy put a spotlight over, and you could see the drunken idiot was up there. And then a whole bunch of people jumped on him and started beating the hell out of him.
There is justice in the world.
And they carried him out. The Andy Frains, remember the old Andy Frains?
Right.
The old Andy Frain guys came in, and they were like trying to break it up and everything. And then finally they moved the crowd out. And the spotlight guy swings it back onto the stage, and Ian Anderson's like, "Okay, we can continue." And then they started the song again.
Yes.
But I saw them in 80 something. I want to say 86 or 87. Mm. And it was their, get this, it was when they released the 20th anniversary CDs, set with the 20th anniversary.
Purple box set.
And so we went to, and it was the 20th anniversary, and this was supposed to be their retirement tour,
right.
Which is of course true of every band. I mean, the Stones just played at Soldier Field a couple of weeks ago, and they're in their mid-70s.
I die before I get old.
Exactly. And the Who is still going,
Yeah.
So, but this was really funny because it was the 20th anniversary. It's probably going to be their retirement, last time to see Tull, and it was, you know, obviously their greatest hits, you know, collection. So they were going to do all the stuff, and. When they came out on stage, a couple of them were in wheelchairs being pushed out by nurses. Ian Anderson came out on a gurney, and it was like talking about how
an IV drip. I hope.
They brought out IVs and everything, and the nurses brought them out, and they kind of limped onto the stage. And then they took off. They had the hospital gowns on. They took off the hospital gowns, and then they had their regular clothes on underneath. And then they kicked.
Nice.
They kicked ass. But I find it really funny that was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Right.
And Ian Anderson obviously is still touring.
Well, his voice is not holding up these days, but he's still out there.
Well, he's got to be close to 80, right? Ian Anderson? He's got to be, right?
70.
But he's an incredible front man.
I saw their first American tour, 1968, at the Fillmore East.
Oh, man. Now, some of the concerts that you've gone to.
That's the Richard story
We're going to be talking about that in a second. But you were at Woodstock.
Yes.
I want to make this clear.
Yes.
You were at Woodstock.
I was there.
And you're actually writing a book. You're almost done with a book that you're writing. And what's it called?
It's called Woodstock Boy, a 15-Year-Old in the Garden.
So I want to we're going to get into, you know, your experience at Woodstock. We want to talk about Woodstock. What is it, the gathering at Woodstock, Lindsay, historically one of the greatest music festivals of all time,
and
if not the greatest.
It wasn't expected to be anything more than just another concert. You know, there was the Monterey Pop Festival several weeks before that that kind of set the tone. And I think Woodstock was an attempt to capture some of that. Some bands turned down playing there. They thought it was going to be a cheap imitation of the Monterey Pop Festival.
So yeah.
They didn't take part in it. But, you know, the stars just aligned and all the things came together and the crowd behaved and it turned into this... I want to say the signal point for the generation. David Crosby talks about how seeing that crowd there, the hippies, if you want to call them that, the hippie generation realized that they were a movement. They weren't just these isolated islands of alternative people. They were actually a movement that could have some strength and some power. And that was why Woodstock was such an energizing force for our generation.
Yeah. Well, you know, and then just a few months later, the dark side of outdoor.
Altamont,
right. Which is just...
But if you read about that, that was because a lot of stupid decisions were made.
Oh, my God. Gimme Shelter is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's a terrifying and incredible movie.
I have an idea. Let's hire the Hell's Angels with a bunch of cases of beer.
You're right. We'll pay them in beer. That's a good idea. It's just an incredible. I mean, you know, obviously, God, what are the brothers who made the movie?
The Maisels.
They really stumbled onto something. They were just, you know what I mean? It was just like a lot of really lucky or great documentary filmmakers. Right. Just something happens while they're filming.
Something horrible happened
there. And it's a really genuinely terrifying movie to watch. Every single time I watch it, I'm just like,
including,
oh my God.
Mick watching the footage.
Yeah.
Afterwards.
Yeah, that's really interesting to watch.
Yes.
To watch their faces, you know, like Mick watching what happened. You know, we were actually going to do, my theater company and I were actually going to do a stage adaptation of it.
Really?
And the audience was going to be on the stage. The plan was I was going to direct it, and the audience would be like from the point of view of the bands on stage, and we were going to recreate all the stuff that happened and actually ride Harleys.
Oh,
into the theater.
Nice.
Because the theater that we were going to do it at had a giant back door that's like a garage door that lifted up, and we were going to roll out the Harleys and actually have them do it. We never got to do it, though. It didn't happen. But anyway, but that represents like the, you know, like they wanted to make another Woodstock, and it just couldn't happen. That was terrible planning and horrible things. But let's talk about the good stuff. We'll talk about Woodstock. You guys hang on for a second. Lindsey Cochran and Richard Pettengill from Great Moments in Vinyl are here, and they're doing the music of Woodstock on Thursday, July 25th at the Rialto Square Theater in Joliet. And we'll get to more of that coming up right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. That was from Great Moments in Vinyl. You actually performed that on, that was performed on Roe's show, right?
Yeah. He had us on like 2 weeks ago or something like that. Yeah. So I brought it some musicians down here and we did a couple of songs.
Yeah, we got a nice performance space here. On the 18th floor. It's really nice.
I guess Jacob Dylan had been there, was bragging about it. Everyone that I saw there said, Jacob loves our performance space.
Well, you know, as soon as we moved here from the Tribune building to 303 Wacker here on the 18th floor, beautiful facilities here, just fantastic. And they did such a nice job adding that performance space.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you can have bands in there, there's a stage, you can watch from there.
Absolutely.
And it's really cool. And and I like this place because I finally have an office. After 30-something years of working here. So welcome back. Lindsey Cochran and Richard Pettengill are here, Great Moments in Vinyl, and you guys are performing. Great Moments in Vinyl plays the music of Woodstock.
Absolutely.
Celebrating the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. It's July 25th at the Rialto Square Theater in Joliet. Your tickets are available now.
Yes.
So get your tickets now, rialtosquare.com.
Here's our little hint that if you buy them at the box office, you don't have to pay the service fee.
Ah.
Save yourself $15.
Okay. $15 is the service fee?
My partner, Melissa, bought herself one ticket, a $20 ticket. I think the final cost was $34.50 or something.
Jeez.
Are you kidding me? Wow. Well, if you want to order them, you can, rialtosquare.com, or just go to the box office and get them there. But make sure you go. Okay, so who are the other musicians? I know the two of you, Richard and Lindsey. Who are the other musicians?
You met Bill Grady.
Yes.
Who's our Jimi Hendrix and a number of other things for this show. He's going to be part of the band. Andrea Bunch, I believe you met.
Yep.
She's going to be our female singer on a number of things. The Melanie song, the Janis Joplin, Joan Baez, yeah.
Oh, sure.
Grace Slick.
I don't want to give away the little what we're going to do for the encore after Jimmy plays, but it involves a certain song called Woodstock, and so she'll be involved with that. And then, let me see here. We got Dan Ingenthrone, who plays in a lot of bands around in the Chicago area. He's going to be singing a number of songs like the Burt Summer America, the Bad Moon Rising tune from CCR. And Jonathan Reed playing drums. He's the guy that I performed Jimi Hendrix with Bill Grady. And then Christian Rogala, an amazing percussionist and vocalist. When he gets up and does Joe Cocker,
watch out.
That is worth the price of admission.
Is that right? He channels it, man.
Is that right?
Oh my God. Check out the rehearsal video I have on Facebook.
Oh, okay.
Or, you know, have your producer pull it up. I think I might have given him a clip.
Maybe we'll throw it up on the website.
Absolutely.
So people can check it out.
Use it as one of the bumpers. Because, I mean, this guy, when he sings, you're like, oh, my God.
Okay. John Belushi-like.
You know, but in a respectful kind of way.
Yeah. Well, if you guys have seen that footage of John Belushi singing next to
it's not quite as satiric as Belushi's.
No. But,
I think I was watching live when that happened. I couldn't believe it.
I remember I was watching it, too. And it was...
Joe brutal. Didn't punch him out.
No, he didn't at all. I mean, he had a great, you know, he had a great sense of humor about it and everything. But it was really, because I mean that, you know, that was one of Belushi's signature things in National Lampoon and everything. So, but anyway, all right. So now, what was it about the set list? You were trying to not
find
do the stuff that's on the albums.
We wanted to find songs that would represent the bands that were there that people still remember, that still mean something to people today. So that's why we picked the songs that we did. The Santana, we're doing Canned Heat, Going Up the Country.
Oh, I love that song.
Yeah, I'm playing flute on that.
Who's singing that?
Dan Ingenfrom.
Can he do a good?
We try not to imitate so much.
Oh, okay.
You know, Richard and I went to a show once by Classic Albums Live. Good band. They did David Bowie, but they did the Ziggy Stardust album, and the entire set was kind of a spot-on imitation.
Yeah.
And after a while, you're not hearing the music. You're hearing whether or not it sounds like the album.
Right.
And we want to veer away from that.
Yeah, I know. That's what you guys are maybe pride yourself on doing.
Kick people back into enjoying the song as it's happening live rather than saying, I don't know if he really sounds like Joe Cocker there.
Right.
You know, anyway.
All right. So you went to Woodstock, Richard.
Yeah.
We have to talk about this, obviously. You're writing an entire book about it.
Right.
How did this happen? You were 15?
Okay, I was 15, summer of 69. I was at my summer home in Western Massachusetts, where we had no TV or radio or anything. So the only way I heard about Woodstock was through the New York Times that my uncle had, and I saw that little ad with, you know, the bird on the guitar neck.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, what's this? Oh, my God.
And then you looked at the lineup.
Yeah.
And at this point, you're 2 years into playing guitar.
Yeah. And I had all the albums of all those artists. I was a music fanatic.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I need to go to this thing. Mom, can I go? She's like, sure. I'm like, really? Not only that, she gave me the family car and put a trailer hitch on the car so I could take my uncle's camping trailer up there, and we were comfortable, and we had food and water and a camp stove, and we were dry and sleeping off the ground.
Who else went with you?
My older cousin Jeff, who was 17, so he could drive. I was 15.
Right.
So, and then my younger cousin Chris, who was 14.
Okay.
So the three of us.
So just three teenagers going off to Woodstock.
Yeah.
So you partner. What was it? What was the scene like? Like when you arrived?
Well, fortunately, we sent away for the tickets and they didn't arrive. They didn't arrive. Finally, Tuesday before the weekend, they arrive, and we're like, okay, we got the tickets. Let's go.
Yeah.
So fortunately, we went up on Wednesday, 2 days before the music began. It's a really good thing we did, because we just tooled right on in. There was no traffic. There weren't very many people. Nobody cared about us arriving. There was no security, no nothing.
Yeah.
And we drive up this little road, Heard Road, and we don't even know where the stage is. We pull over and we go, this is a nice place to park.
Yeah.
We get out. We're right at the top of the hill looking down on the stage.
Yeah.
And we parked there for 5 days.
Oh, my God.
Wednesday through Monday morning, the entire time.
Isn't that unbelievable? That's unbelievable. So you was there the whole time. You obviously walked down the hill.
Just walked down the hill, and I was right dead center the entire time. My thing was like the music.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I saw a picture of you. Lindsay, last times he was here, he has it on his computer, and he showed us a picture of teenage you right in the middle there at Woodstock. It must have been unbelievable. And so as the crowds started to show up, was it, you know, you guys got there very early.
Right.
You got your spot, put your camper in that spot. How soon before you had neighbors?
So Wednesday was pretty chill. Thursday, people started really coming in.
Yeah.
And then by Friday morning, it was packed.
It was completely packed.
Yeah.
That was the atmosphere. Or was it just like it was just was it great?
It was really relaxed. I mean, there was just nobody telling you what to do or what not to do. Completely chill.
Yeah.
And all I did those 2 days was to go skinny dipping in the pond with everybody else.
Yeah.
And then went to the hog farm and they were making free natural food and just hanging out for 2 days.
Yeah.
Waiting for the music to start.
Yeah. And then the rains came.
That was Sunday.
Yeah.
The big rain. There was a little rain Friday. Saturday was not bad. Sunday, the serious rainstorm.
Yeah. Yeah. What was that like?
I mean, it was like intense, but the fortunate thing is this was August. It was 80 degrees.
Yeah.
So let's get wet.
Yeah.
Big deal.
Yeah.
You know, I was warm. I was happy. I just took off my shirt, like in that picture. I was took off my shirt, whatever.
Yeah.
Everyone around me is like covered in ponchos and what. I'm just like, whatever.
That's
rain.
Well, yeah, you're 15, man. You're 15 and you're at Woodstock. That's absolutely amazing. Do you still have your ticket, Stubb?
You know, I had it for years, and during one of those moves, you know, it just
went away. That hurts, man.
But I do have my little Hendrix snapshots. I had a little Instamatic camera.
Oh, you had an Instamatic?
I had an Instamatic, and I forgot I had it until the very end, like when Hendrix is playing. And I'm like, oh my God, I have this camera! Start snapping like crazy.
You're going to include those in the book?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, and one of them is on the New York Times website.
Is that right?
Already, yeah.
That you took?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Okay, well, let's talk about the music.
Okay.
Okay, so it starts on Friday.
Right.
What time?
About 5:30. I waited all day. Got down there at 8 a.m., waited all day. Just
where was food, water, all that stuff? How did you guys?
You know, there were some drippy little spigots around. You could get a little bit of water. We brought water, like jugs of spring water, and cans of Dinty Moore beef stew that we heated up on a little camp stove in the trailer. So we were set. You know,
that's amazing.
Yeah. So
you're eating Dinty Moore beef stew. You're drinking spring water all weekend long, and just watching the music.
You know, and there was also the hamburger stand up at the top of the hill and the hog farm serving bulgur, wheat, and veggies.
Yeah.
So it was great.
That's amazing.
And everyone says there was no food. There was food.
There was. Did you make friends while you were there? I mean, obviously, you're there for that length of time. You got to meet people.
Sure. I mean, the people sitting around you, everybody's so friendly and warm. Everybody's so nice. I was amazed by, like, I went by myself so I could insinuate myself anywhere I wanted to be, like right dead center in front of the stage.
And you knew where home base was, so you were fine.
It was right up here.
Yeah.
No problem. So. And nobody gave me a hard time.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, man, we've been here for hours or whatever.
That's great. That's really great. We'll talk about the music and all that stuff, but we have to take a break. And if you want to hear the music from Woodstock, Great Moments in Vinyl, Lindsey Cochran puts this together and gets, you know, as I've said before, Lindsey, you bring together some of the best, most talented musicians in this city.
I feel so lucky sometimes.
It's unbelievable.
I'm staying. I can't believe what these other musicians. I mean, Richard included, the way he plays guitar.
No, he's amazing. And on top of that, I also want to mention Old Town School of Folk, which a lot of people go through those doors who play in your band.
Absolutely.
And that is a breeding ground for amazing musicians.
Yes, absolutely.
So, but anyway, it's going to be Great Moments in Vinyl plays the music of Woodstock. It's July 25th at the Rialto Square Theater in Joliet. You can go to rialtosquare.com. Get your tickets, or you can get them at the box office. Lindsey, Richard, hang on for a second. We'll come back and talk more after this on 720 WGN.
Damn your ears and I'll sing you a song. I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, baby, now.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and it is a Tuesday morning, 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in now, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about the best albums of 1969, celebrating that great year, and we're going to talk about some A-listers who didn't get famous until after 40. So, sometimes life begins after 40. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. What you just heard was Great Moments in Vinyl performing Joe Cocker. And Lindsey Cochran and Richard Pettengill are here from Great Moments in Vinyl, and they will be performing the music of Woodstock and some of the greatest musicians in the city all together celebrating the music of Woodstock July 25th at the Rialto Square Theater in Joliet. And welcome back, Lindsay. Welcome back, Richard.
Thank you.
Yeah,
so that, again, give credit to who that was?
That was Christian Regala doing the singing on that one. And it was sort of a, it was a rehearsal. We didn't have our full force there. We didn't have all the vocalists we needed. Our drummer had somehow, I don't know what happened to him, overslept or something like that. So it was Bill Grady playing the drums. So don't judge us by that particular arrangement.
Yeah.
But the vocalist is be amazing when we put them on stage.
Now, one of the unique things about Great Moments in Vinyl is that you guys perform songs, but you also tell stories.
I tell stories. I'll give you the backstory. On, you know, like there's a great story about Santana being at Woodstock. This is where he made his fame. This is where he came to fame. Bill Graham actually was had been approached to book the band Chicago at Woodstock, and he turned them down because he had this new band that he was grooming. He wanted to introduce them on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And that band happened to be Santana.
Wow.
So they came on stage. Carlos Santana, high as a kite when he took to the stage, because Jerry Garcia had given him some mescaline. And Carlos was thinking to himself, yeah, I'll be on 6 hours from now. I'll have time to come down.
Oh.
Hey, Carlos, you're on next.
Oh, no.
So he's up there just trying to hold on. And at one point he said, I found myself praying to God, please keep me in tune and keep me in time, and I'll never do this again. And then he adds, of course, I lied.
He also said his guitar neck looked like a snake. Well,
of course. You know, one of my favorite stories about you know, musicians taking drugs before a gig is that infamous story of Keith Moon taking horse tranquilizer before a concert. He decided to take some horse tranq before a concert. Halfway through the second song, he just completely collapses and passes out. And Pete Townsend says, you know, they carry Keith Moon off stage, you know, knocked out from horse tranq. And so Pete Townsend says, anybody in the house play drums?
Oh, this is that story.
And some kid raised his hand. He's like 18 years old. He's like, well, come on up. And this guy ended up playing drums with The Who.
Wow. Yeah,
it's a great, it's one of my favorite stories. So, Richard, you said Friday around 5:30 it started. Tell me about the acts and
yeah,
everything.
So, you know, finally you hear this guy, Chipmunk, his deep, rich voice. Ladies and gentlemen, Richie Havens. And it's like, I was like, yes, because I knew Richie Havens. I had his records. He had two records out at that point. I had older sisters who were cool. They had great music. So most people had never heard of Richie Havens.
Yeah, yeah.
So who's this guy? You know, but I knew all of his songs. It was great. And he came on, and it, you know, it's well known that he played a long, long set, like 3 hours or so, because
is that right?
Because nobody else was there, and they kept saying, "Could you go back and do some more? Do you know? Keep doing more encores." And
wow.
You know, so
wow.
And no one else was there to go on. So and so famously, when he did "Freedom, Motherless Child," that was an improvisation. He improvised "Freedom."
That's amazing,
and that's the song that put him on the map.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right. What was next?
After that, the Swami comes out. Swami Satchidananda. And gives this invocation, you know, spirituality, yoga, etc. So that was nice.
Was that like 45 minutes worth?
No, it wasn't that long.
Oh, it wasn't that long.
No, it wasn't that long. And then a band called Sweetwater, sort of jazz fusion-y with a female vocalist that didn't make a big impact. But then there were some really great things like Tim Hardin, who I loved. If I Were a Carpenter, Misty Roses.
Yeah.
I thought he was great.
Yeah.
I loved all of his stuff. Then it started to get really good. Ravi Shankar and Ala Raka did a beautiful set of ragas. And then Arlo Guthrie comes on. You know, New York State throughways closed, man. A lot of freaks. and then, you know, Joan Baez finished out the night. Just magisterial, beautiful, stunning voice ringing into the night.
Yeah.
And it went till about 1:30. It was kind of raining that night, but not hard.
Yeah.
Just drizzling. It was a beautiful start, like a folk, an homage to the role of folk music in rock and roll history.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. So that's just the first day.
Just the first night.
All right. What about the next one?
So the next day I get up and I plant myself, and this band called Quill comes on, kind of unknown and justifiably unknown. So then another band like the Keith Hartley band. So there were some, you know, bands that weren't up to snuff that came on. But eventually we started to get like Canned Heat.
Yeah.
John Sebastian did his little set, which was nice. And then Mountain came on.
Yeah.
Mountain.
And you gotta love a fat guitarist.
Yeah, it was great. You know,
I love Leslie West.
You can sort of tell who's going to come on when you see who's coming on stage and setting up equipment. This big bear of a man comes out and he starts ripping out these huge riffs, and I'm like, who's that? And I actually recognized him because I had seen his first band, The Vagrants, in high school.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, back in Northport, Long Island. So that's Leslie West.
He's amazing. Popularity. I love those guys.
Felix Popularity.
One of my favorite songs ever is by Mountain. That's themed from the Imaginary Western. That's one of my favorite songs of all time.
And that's the first time I ever heard it. They announced it as being co-written by Jack Bruce. So yeah. I was a huge Cream fan.
Of course.
Yeah.
All right. So Mountain. And then?
Mountain. Well, then I had never heard the Grateful Dead before,
mm-hmm.
and I know you're not a huge Deadhead, but I am.
I know you are.
So that was the life-changing moment for me.
That's, by the way, my favorite moment in Gimme Shelter is when they go, yeah, no, we're leaving.
We're out of here.
Jerry Garcia's like, yeah, no, we're gonna go.
Yeah, we're not. We're not playing this thing.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, but they had a really hard time that night because they were getting shocked by their instruments, and it's legendarily not their best set.
Yeah.
But my view is, like, it changed my life, so it couldn't have been too terrible.
Exactly. You know? That's awesome.
After that, John Fogerty comes on. Creedence did an incredible high-energy set.
Yeah.
And then Janis
mm-hmm.
Comes on with her Cosmic Blues Band.
Yeah.
By that time, my back was killing me. I was so tired. Believe it or not, I had to, after four songs of Janis, I walked my way back up to the trailer.
And you had to get some rest.
I fell asleep listening to Janis sing Summertime and The Living Is Easy.
Oh, that's amazing. All right, and then the final day.
Well, and I have to mention that I missed the second half of Janis, Sly and the Family Stone, The Who, and the Jefferson Airplane.
Oh, my God.
And I was right at the top of the hill. I slept through everything.
Oh, man.
I slept like a log.
Oh, man. All right, well, then you got some rest.
Right.
So you were ready for Sunday.
Which is really good because I had to make it all the way through to Monday morning.
Yeah.
So Sunday, Joe Cocker comes on, incredible set. Who's this guy?
Yeah.
You know, with all of his, like, his
mannerisms.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Huge rainstorm, got soaked.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, things get going again. You got 10 Years After, Johnny Winter, The Band, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, Sha Na Na, my favorite of the festival.
Oh, Lindsay, you love Sha Na. You love yourself some Sha Na Na, don't you?
Sorry.
Yeah.
By Monday morning, Bowser. I was so desperate for Hendrix. It was all about waiting for Jimmy.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, oh, my God, I got to see Hendrix. And then we thought after Butterfield finished that it would be Hendrix. And then it's, ladies and gentlemen, Sha Na Na. And we just all lost it. It's like, who are these greaser idiots?
Yeah.
You know, get them off the stage. But finally, Jimmy came on, and it was just, like, unbelievable.
Jimmy had to follow Sha Na Na?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
That's a tough act to follow. That must have been really amazing. The drive home.
Yeah, you know what? We were covered with layers of mud.
Yeah.
So it's Monday morning, 10, 11 a.m. We go back up to the car. The car is sunk in the mud.
Oh,
I mean, we tried to get going, and the wheels are just spinning.
Oh, man.
And we're like, what do we do now? And then along comes this farmer with a tractor. And we're like, okay, he's pulling people out, but what's he going to charge us? You know, he's got us over a barrel.
Yeah.
He pulls us out, doesn't charge a dime. Have a good day.
Oh, man.
That's
amazing.
And we just tool on back home. I took a shower, a bath, a shower, and another bath, and then another shower.
Yeah. Wow. It's an incredible story. And your book, when do you see it possibly?
I'm going to be sending it out to publishers this fall and hope to get it out.
Has it been fun to write?
Yeah, very much.
Did you get in contact with people that you went with? Or
I interviewed my cousin and my sister. I even ran into my sister during Canned Heat set.
Oh, she was there.
So weird.
Yeah.
I didn't even know she was coming. It's like, hey.
and a pretty crowded place, too, and you ended up running into your sister.
Yeah, I was going over to the hog farm for a bite to eat.
Yeah.
And there's my sister, and she's like, she was tripping, actually. So she said she did not remember seeing me there.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So meanwhile, you got Santana on stage thinking his guitar neck is a snake.
Snake.
Right, and then your sister's tripping, doesn't even remember you.
Right.
That's an amazing story, man. Rip down some of the other concerts that you've seen. Some of the big ones besides, I mean, obviously Woodstock is massive, but.
I mean, I went to Watkins Glen a few years later with the Allman Brothers, the band, and the Grateful Dead. Geez, I saw a bunch of concerts at the Fillmore East. Richie Havens, Nina Simone, and Isaac Hayes one night.
Yeah. Jeez. It's amazing.
It's, you know, it's just kind of lucky. I was lucky. I was young in the 60s, and I had a lot of good influences from my older sisters who were into great music.
Yeah.
And they took me to a lot of stuff. I saw the Jefferson Airplane for free at Stony Brook campus outdoors.
Yeah. Well, it's all so the Woodstock adventure is going to be in the book, and I hope everybody gets it. Lindsay, a quick story before we get out of here?
Sure, right. You know, Grateful Dead were on stage getting shocked by their equipment and just having a lousy time of it. And Garcia kind of looked back on the show and really, you know, put it down, denigrated the fact that they were there. But John Fogerty followed them, and he came away with a different perspective. He said he was ready to rock out, and we waited and waited. Finally, it was our turn to go on stage. 500,000 people out in front of us. And they were asleep. These people were out, says Fogerty. It was sort of like a painting of a Dante scene, bodies from hell all intertwined and asleep and covered with mud. And this is the moment I will never forget as long as I live, John Fogerty says. A quarter mile away in the darkness on the other edge of this bowl, there was some guy flicking his lighter. And in the night I hear, "Don't worry about it, John. We're with you." I played the rest of the show for that guy.
Oh, that's great. Well, you'll hear stories like that on Thursday night, July 25th at the Rialto Square Theater as Great Moments and Vinyl play the music of Woodstock. And you're actually going to have some pictures that are going to be...
Well, actually, Baron Molman is the Rolling Stone photographer who was there at Woodstock, covering it for the magazine.
And he's going to be there.
He's going to be there showing his photos, talking about some of his reminiscences. I want Richard to be there because obviously he's got some first-person stories. So,
it's going to be great.
Multimedia experience.
There you go. Great Moments and Vinyl plays the music of Woodstock and more. July 25th, Rialto Square Theater. Check out rialtosquare.com. Always a pleasure. Richard, good to see you again. I haven't seen you in a long time. Let's make it sooner, okay?
Yeah.
Lindsay, always a great time.
Thank you, sir.
All right, we'll take a break here for the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. Two for Tuesday. You're here, Two for Tuesday. That's one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. What do we got there?
Lulu wanted to hear Lil Hendrix.
Lil Hendrix.
Talking
to Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, talking
to Vic reacting very positively.
Because I recognized it.
Yay! There you go.
I almost talked to Tom on the squawker and said, "Is that Hendrix?" But I didn't want to embarrass myself.
No, that was Hendrix, man. You know you're Hendrix now. That's fantastic. So, you know, Vic, we are going to be talking about the, right here, we've got the best albums of 1969 that we're going to be talking about in honor of our Woodstock conversation that we just had.
Which was awesome.
And I know that you've listened to a bunch of these.
I'm sure I have.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list and we've talked a lot about them, and I think you're gonna recognize a lot of these. 1969 evidently a really, really, really strong year for music.
It's almost all of them that I'm listening to. Now I'm gonna be over there writing for a lot of it, but I'm gonna go back and listen to this podcast later for sure.
Excellent. Okay, cool. So that's Vic, and he's doing a musical journey on his own. He's busy in the newsroom writing his news reports, which he does top bottom of every hour. But so we're talking about 1969, quite a year. You know, it was the moon landing. We celebrated that. We had the great Rod Pyle on with us to talk about that incredible anniversary, 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission. And Woodstock, we just talked about that, the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. Richard Pettengill was actually there and recounted these incredible stories that you just heard. He was a 15-year-old kid who was at Woodstock and tells all these great stories. In fact, has a book written about it, which is going to be released in the fall. But we thought we'd talk a little bit more about the music of 1969. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. If we get into some of these albums that you really love, 312-981-7200. Here's what we've got. This is from Paste Magazine. Again, if you want to read the entire article, the stuff that we're talking about on the air is always posted and connected with our Facebook page. So you should like our Facebook page right now and join us on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Nick D Show. facebook.com/Nick D Show. So here's what they say. We've heard that 1969 was when a certain singer-songwriter got his first real six string, and he bought it at a five and dime, but plenty of others were already releasing some damn fine albums. They call it classic rock and jazz and folk and soul for some reason. They call it the final gasp of the tumultuous 60s was an incredible year as music for music as adventurous albums and from the best acts of the 60s collided with those who would dominate the following decade. Experimentation abound with genres blending into country rock, noisy kraut rock, psychedelic funk, and jazzy art rock. We've already looked back at the many milestones from the Beatles' final concert to Woodstock and the disastrous Altamont. And now we're looking at the albums that shaped the end of the decade. So here includes the iconic albums, the iconic artists, and the wonderful avant-garde albums that pushed genre boundaries, and some underrated gems that maybe you can discover too. So according to Pace Magazine, we have 30 of the best albums of 1969, and we're going to talk about those. And we want to hear from you. Talk and text. Phone lines are open at 312-981-7200. Text lines are open too. 312-981-7200. It's Doc. Hey, Doc.
Hey, man. I got a quick Sean and I Hendrix story for you. You know, I'm in the car 60 hours a week. I can't remember where I heard this, but I heard it last week. And somebody was interviewing one of the original members of Sean and I, and he said they were playing, I don't know, New York, New Jersey. They're playing a club several nights in a row, and Hendrix came in.
Uh-huh.
And he was rehearsing or something, and he loved those guys. And he said Hendrix came in another two, three nights, and he tells him, he says, "You know, I'm getting ready to play this festival. You guys would go over great there." And he was instrumental in getting them the gig. And in the movie, they're pretty early in the movie. You think, well, they're pretty early in Woodstock.
Yeah.
No, they were on the last night.
Yeah.
And the weather was about to be bad. And they come to Hendrix and they said, "Hey, we want to put you on, you know, right now before the weather gets bad and you won't get to play and get these people out of here." And he said, "No, there's three or four acts." He said, "Those guys have gone to all the trouble to be here and rehearse. They deserve their shot." He says, "I won't go on unless they get their shot."
Wow.
And the guy from Sean and I said, that was a deal breaker for our career. Had we not gone on, nobody would have known who we were.
Wow.
But it was all because of Hendrix.
And that's amazing.
It was a great story to hear firsthand from him.
Yeah, that's
and
great. That's
by
great.
The way, I've seen Sean and I both in Kansas City and St. Louis. And, you know, they come out and they go, "Here they are, greased up and ready to kick ass, Sean and I."
Right.
They all come out to the front of the stage, comb their hair, flick their wrists, and that grease flies for like the first 10 rows. I loved them.
Yeah. All right, Doc. Thanks, man.
All right.
That's a great story. Take care. That's a great story. Hendrix loved Sha Na Na. How is it? I mean, that just seems weird, right?
I don't know. Maybe Hendrix just had a thing for greasers.
You know, Sha Na Na, like everybody in the 70s, had a variety show.
Yes.
And it was on, I remember Sha Na Na was on, because there were a bunch of sort of strange syndicated shows that would follow SNL when I was younger. And I obviously, you know, to this day, I watch SNL every Saturday. And, you know, started in 1975 with the very first episode. George Carlin was the host, and I've watched it ever since. And they would put stuff on afterwards, like back in the old days, before SETV was 90 minutes long on NBC, it was syndicated in half an hour long. And in fact, Harold Ramis was a cast member on the very first incarnation of SETV. And that would follow SNL. And then they would do, like, the Hudson Brothers had this show called, what was the Hudson Brothers show called? Like, Bizarre? No, Bizarre was with John Biner. It was like Crazy or Loony or something. The Hudson Brothers, they had a syndicated show.
Was it the Hudson Brothers Razzle Dazzle show?
No.
No?
No. But, I mean, the Hudson Brothers, it was a half-an-hour syndicated show, and that was on. And I think it was like a goofy or crazy or loony or something like that. But the Hudson Brothers was a show that was on. And also Sha Na Na. They would show Sha Na Na at like 1 o'clock in the morning after SNL. And John Bowser Bauman was like the main, like, you know, the sort of the front man of Sha Na Na. And he would go on to be like on his own. He would like do game shows as Bowser. He would be dressed up in with the cut off sleeve shirt and the greasy hair. But he was John Bowser Bauman. And then he became just John Bauman, no grease in his hair, hosted a couple of game shows, including the hour-long Hollywood Square / Match Game Hour. So Gene Rayburn, of course, the great Gene Rayburn would host the Match Game half, and then John Bowser Bauman would host the Hollywood Squares half. So that's the sort of the insane career that John Bowser Bauman had.
Now, was it the Hudson Brothers? Was it Bonkers?
Bonkers, that's it.
Yeah.
I knew it was like crazy or loony or... Was that a phone call?
Yeah, we had a quick phone call. He said, it's Bonkers.
It's Bonkers.
I'm 90% sure it's
Yeah,
Bonkers.
It's Bonkers. That's absolutely right. Thank you. Thank you, caller. I appreciate that. But yeah, Bonkers. That would be on at like, 12:30 after SETV, after SNL. Bonkers with the Hudson Brothers. One of the Hudson Brothers is, they're all goofy, three goofy Hudson Brothers. One of them is Kate Hudson's father. Was married to Goldie Hawn, or maybe not. Yeah, they were married, and that's
wow.
I don't know which Hudson brother is her. I think it's Bill Hudson, because there was Bill Hudson, Mark Hudson. And I don't remember the other Hudson.
I can't believe. I wonder if it was the one with the mustache.
That's Bill. No, that's Mark. Mark is the he's got purple hair now. He's just a loon. I think it was. I think it Mark might be. Yeah, I can't remember.
I'm gonna say it's Bill Hudson. Yeah, it's Bill. Bill Hudson is Kate Hudson's dad.
Yeah, Bill Hudson was married to Goldie Hawn. So it's hard to believe that there was a time when Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn weren't together.
Yeah,
because he was married to who Kurt Russell was married to, right?
Before
Susan Hubley. She's the girl.
Oh, really?
She's the girl in the Chock Full of Nuts, in the coffee shop in the middle of the night. That's her. They were married at that time. In Escape from New York, for those people who don't know what I'm referring to. Not all of us know the shorthand. Like, oh, she's the girl in Chock Full of Nuts.
Yeah.
People are like, what the hell are you talking about? Yeah, that was the girl in Chock Full of Nuts that Snake Plissken runs into, and she gets dragged down by the crazies.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Susan Hubley.
Okay.
She was in Vice Squad. Have you ever seen Vice Squad?
You know what? I think I have.
Oh, you'd remember.
Maybe I haven't then. The name is very familiar, Vice Squad.
Listen, man. Listen to me. Chicago and Gary Sherman directed that movie. Gary Sherman, responsible for some fantastic B-movies, lives here in Chicago. Great guy. He did Dead and Buried. You ever see Dead and Buried? James Ferentz.
Oh, man.
You got to see Dead and Buried. Dan O'Bannon wrote it, man.
Okay.
So Gary Sherman directed that. He directed Vice Squad. He directed Lisa, which is a really cool movie about... Like a guy stalking a girl, and she makes wacky phone calls and she calls the wrong guy. She's a teenage girl. She calls up like flirting with guys, calls the wrong guy. Lunatic killer. Fantastic.
Oh, he did Poltergeist 3.
He did Poltergeist 3, which is my favorite of the Poltergeist movies.
Well, there you go. That makes sense.
But Vice Squad. Let me explain something to you. Susan Hubley's the lead. She's the lead in it. There's a performance in that movie by a guy named Wings Hauser. Wings Hauser. He plays the pimp Ramrod in this movie. And I have to explain to you right now, it is truly, Wings Hauser as Ramrod in Vice Squad, truly one of the greatest and craziest B-movie villain performances of all time. I'm not exaggerating. Like you
Pimp
see,
called Ramrod.
I'm telling you, Ramrod, Wings Hauser as Ramrod in Vice Squad, one of the most insanely awesome villain performances in the history of B-movies. I'm telling you. Just for him alone, the movie's worth seeing. He's unbelievable. And Wings Hauser's been in a few other movies. He was in Norman Mailer's Tough Guys Don't Dance, which is a movie that I absolutely adore and is completely certifiably insane. You got to see Vice Squad. Wings
Vice
Hauser,
Squad.
Man. Yeah.
Vice Squad.
Vice Squad. Directed by Gary Sherman. Classic. How the hell did we get on that? Oh,
Hudson Brothers.
Season Hubley. Yeah, okay. Kurt Russell's first wife. That's how
we've made it.
All right. All right. Music from 1969. We're going to get to that right after we take a break here. The first one up, though, is Janis Joplin's first solo record. That's number 30. It's I Got Them Old Cosmic Blues Again, Mama. All right, music from 69 is what we're talking about. You want to jump in with your favorites or your thoughts? 312-981-7200. And an incredible amount of great music came out in that year, and we're going to talk all about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome back. Vic's writing his newscast there and just rocking out to some Hendrix. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and that was the second of a twofer for Jimi Hendrix. Two for Tuesday, everybody. Yeah, man, two for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. One artist, two songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. That's also the number to call or to text with your thoughts on some of the best music of 1969. Paste Magazine put together a list. We're celebrating Woodstock, the last segment, the last hour. And now we're staying in the year of 1969 and talking about the best albums. So Janis Joplin, I Got Them Old Cosmic Blues Again Mama, is the first on the list. Joni Mitchell comes in at number 29 with Clouds. If you're a fan, there are many Joni Mitchells to choose from. There's folky Joni. There's 80s Joni, who so gleefully embraced the synth spirit. There's blue Joni. And there's painter Joni. On her second album, Clouds, Joni's just Joni, fully herself and almost untarnished by production. As on Blue, she sticks almost exclusively to acoustic guitar, an instrument that, like her paintbrush, allows her to tell stories about relationships with herself and in others in the most colorful ways possible. Chelsea Morning, I think you understand. New York City is a character in and of itself on the album Clouds. 28, classic. James Brown, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. They don't call James Brown the Godfather of Soul for nothing, though he was best known for his later funk masterpieces like 1973's The Payback. His 27th studio album, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, was a successful combustion of his soul and pop leanings. The funkiest and most famous cut on this album is the bold title track with its unapologetic pro-black message. The album's tantalizing grooves, smooth brass, and swaying gospel organs elevate the record. But the main attraction is Brown's vocals. Sweet, one moment ramping up with and fiery and sensual, the next. Brown's output was always robust, releasing three original full-length and an album of jazz standards in 1969, before dropping four LPs and a Christmas album the previous year.
Wow.
That's a lot, man.
Yeah, it's weird. It seemed like musicians were putting out a lot more music much quicker.
Yeah.
You could even look at Zeppelin. They did, you know, two albums in the same year.
Right.
And that's unheard of now. People
completely
don't do that now.
Oh, no way. Not at all. But yeah, and by the way, the James Brown Christmas album is fantastic.
I can't say I've ever heard it.
Have you ever heard Santa Go Straight to the Ghetto?
No.
Whoa! Come on now, man. Find it online, man.
Okay. I got to click away from the Vice Squad trailer.
Right. Santa Go Straight to the Ghetto by James Brown.
Oh,
that is a fan. It's one of the greatest Christmas songs of all time. Santa Go Straight to the Ghetto.
Oh, my gosh. Now, what year was this? This was
69.
So this was
this year, the year that we're talking. No, 68.
It was the year before. 68.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Let me see if I can. Oh, my gosh.
Hitch up your reindeer. Go straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Fill every stocking you find. The kids are gonna love you so. Leave a toy for Johnny. Leave a doll for Mary. Leave something pretty for Donnie.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, man.
That is spectacular.
It's amazing.
Santa Claus goes straight to the ghetto.
Yeah, it's fantastic. The whole Christmas album is great. That's like one of the greatest Christmas. Now, you know what my favorite Christmas song is?
What is it?
Fairy Tale in New York.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's the greatest Christmas song of all time.
Yeah, no, that is that gets a few plays around the household for us.
It's the greatest Christmas song of all time. I mean, it's great all year round, but I think it's the best Christmas song.
Really, not
ever.
Is that you, Santa Claus?
No. But yeah. All right. Hey, it's Art. Speaking of Joliet, it's a tribute to Woodstock concert. I remember a series of concerts at Joliet Central High School back in the early 70s that included Jethro Tull one time, Three Dog Night another, and I'm pretty sure Cheech and Chong was there, if not at the Rialto itself, but at Joliet Central. Joliet Central High School, Cheech and Chong playing a high school?
Nice.
Hey, man, pass the dope. So you know Three Dog Night. You're familiar with Three Dog Night.
Yeah, Jeremiah was a Bullfrog and all
yeah,
that.
I mean, they had monster hits in the early 70s. I mean, they were massive. Mm-hmm. So years ago, I used to hang out at this bar called Ginger's Ale House, which is now A.J. Hudson's. It's on the corner of Grace and Ashland.
Oh, yeah, that Liverpool bar now.
Yeah, it's a Liverpool bar. Yeah. British guy, Jamie Hale, owned it. And I worked there for a long time. So, yes, I would. There were times when I would serve drinks to guys at 6 o'clock in the morning because, you know, soccer was on. So, anyway, they used to have a guy play there named Stuart, British guy. He would play there on Sunday nights. And he had his acoustic guitar, and he would do covers, and he was a really cool dude. And so every once in a while, my friends and I would play with him because I played drums, and another guy played guitar. And we would always – speaking of Hendrix, All Along the Watchtower. So, and he used to call us the Guinness Boys Choir. And so we would go up and sing, we would sing that. And so he was playing at Ginger's and we would go up and play with him. And one night he's like, yeah, you know, my friends from Three Dog Night are coming down tonight. And I was like, what? So Three Dog Night shows up and we were going to play with them. I was like, I'm going to play drums with Three Dog Night. This is unbelievable. So Three Dog Night, they come in, we meet them. Perfectly nice guys, and then you know we're hoping to hear you know one or we're hoping to hear you know Eli's Coming or any of the you know like the great songs, Old Fashioned Love Song, Joy to the World, as you mentioned, hit after hit after hit, and we were like, hey man, can you play Eli's Coming? Because Eli's Coming is my favorite Three Dog Night song, and they're like, oh no man, we're not gonna play any of our songs, it's too much like work. So they did like Twist and Shout and stuff. And I was like, come on, man. And I ended up not playing. I was like, I'm not playing on Twist and Shout.
I could do that with anybody.
Exactly. Oh, no, man, it's too much like work. Like, shut up. So
you don't get to say that, Three Dog Night. That's
come
not
on.
Fair.
I'm requesting a songs that you guys are responsible for. Wouldn't you be, don't you think you should be flattered by that? Like, I want to hear. So, but anyway, but yeah, I mean, they did, you know, they did Harry Nilsson's One. And then, of course, you know, Amy Mann did it better so, because it's in the greatest movie of all time. All right. So let's take a break. We'll come back. Music from 1969 is what we're talking about. Lots of great stuff there. And we'll get to the news after this. Yeah. So who requested the Creedence?
That's coming to us from Tom. Listener Tom.
So the listeners so far, it's 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. The listeners are getting into the theme of this morning's show.
I'm not kidding. The minute they heard Woodstock, it was CCR,
exactly.
Hendrix. We'll hear a little Steely Dan later.
Oh, very cool. They weren't at Woodstock, but...
No, but close.
But they're the Dan, so... Vic, did you recognize that one too?
So I'm embarrassed because let me say, I recognized it, but I couldn't put my finger on it. And yeah, I've listened to one album by
Creedence.
Yeah. Now I want to go back and listen to it again.
Oh, they're great. John Fogerty, one of the best American songwriters ever.
Yeah, I got to dig more into him, more into CCR. Started digging into Jimmy Page tonight. I hadn't listened to anything him, but man, his music's good.
Yeah, good old Jimmy Page. All right. 312-981-7200. We were talking about the music of 1969. And speaking of Creedence, Creedence is next here with Bayou Country. Creedence Clearwater Revival, Bayou Country comes in at number 27. They were a commercial juggernaut. They had 9 top 10 hits between 1969 and 1971. They outsold the Beatles in 1960. Wow, they outsold the Beatles in 1969. That's how big Creedence was. They covered I Put a Spell on You. They did the song Gloomy, Susie Q, which is a classic, Graveyard Train, and, of course, Proud Mary, which is one of their biggest hits. And, of course, The Fortunate Son, which is perhaps the best song he ever wrote. I remember, you know, there was I've told this story before, and I think I told you this story, Vic, about how there was a huge falling out between his brother and the rest of the band. Creedence, John Fogerty, and there were some massive legal and money issues and a big sift between the band. And so for years, he wouldn't play any Creedence songs. Like when John Fogerty went out on the road, he refused to play Creedence songs. So it was just his solo stuff that he played. But then one year he was playing at a tribute to Vietnam veterans. And Fortunate Song, Fortunate Son is one of the most compelling and angriest anti-Vietnam songs told from the point of view of veterans, of soldiers in Vietnam. And it is an unbelievable song. So he's playing at this Vietnam veterans tribute, and like hundreds and hundreds, you know, of veterans in front of the stage. And he hadn't played any Creedence songs in years. And then suddenly he was like, screw it. And he played Fortunate Son. And I've never seen a crowd go as nuts. It was one of the most emotional things I've ever seen. Like, these guys were losing their minds.
I do remember you telling me that story.
It is an unbelievable story. And he that was the only time he played it, was just for those guys. He played Fortunate Son. And my God, that performance was unbelievable.
That's
it was
how you break just down the house.
It was just unbelievable, and he was so passionate and sincere about it. And it's such a great song. Fortunate Son is, I think, it's the best song John Fogerty's ever written, and he's written some, you know, amazing songs. 804 area code says, "I got a backstage pass to Sha Na Na. Ooh, got to meet Bowser.
Did you get free grease?
Yeah, and I got to watch their opening act, Muddy Waters opens up for Sha Na Na.
Yeah, a little guy named Muddy Waters.
Come on, man.
That seems out of place to me.
It seems crazy, right? That's like when the Monkees opened up for Hendrix. No, Hendrix, I'm sorry, Hendrix opened up for the Monkees. Yeah, Hendrix opened up for the Monkees.
That's a weird bill regardless.
Yeah.
That's a weird combination.
Hendrix opened up for the Monkees. That's sort of one of those legendary...
Like, was it at least in the era where they were playing that Porpoise song or whatever? When it got weird? That's what I would want to know.
So, yeah, Hendrix opening up for the Monkees, which is really strange. You know what show I missed when I was a kid? Man. And I don't know why we didn't get tickets for it, because I went to a ton of concerts in the 70s. For some reason, I don't know what happened. We had something planned. I don't remember exactly why I didn't go. Thin Lizzy opening for Queen.
Boy, you got something wrong with you.
Yeah, I said something had to be out of my control, because to miss Thin Lizzy opening for come on,
that's ridiculous.
Come on,
that's absurd.
And obviously that'll never happen again, because Lion is dead, and so is Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
First thing I did when I went to Dublin, went right to his statue.
Got
to
go see Thin Lizzy.
Went right to Phil Lynott's statue. That's the first thing we did. As soon as we got, I was like, Heather, let's go. We're going right now. We're going straight to Phil Lynott.
Bow at the altar.
Oh my God. You know, it's funny, they're from Dublin, as you know.
Thin Lizzy
is from Dublin. And we were in Galway, we went to a pub, and nothing but Thin Lizzy stuff all over the walls. Like, nothing. And there was a back room that was I take that back. Everything was covered from, I mean, I'm not kidding, ceiling to floor, nothing but Thin Lizzy stuff everywhere. And I'm like, I asked the bartender, I was like, Are you from Dublin? He's like, no, the owner's from Dublin, obviously. But there was a room in the back that was dedicated to Rory Gallagher. So it was like the entire bar was all Phil Lynott, and then you go in the back room and there's a Rory Gallagher wing. So, all right, let's see. Here's Tom on WGN. Hey, Tom.
Hey, how's it going, Nick?
All right.
Hey, it's
up?
A great show tonight. I was telling the producer, whoever answered the call, my first concert that I ever went to on a date was Three Dog Night. And I believe it was probably at the Auditorium Theater, but, you know, the girl I was dating at the time, we had to take the L down, but I dressed in a sport coat and a tie. I can't believe it. You know, I don't know what it was at that time of year, but that was one of my favorite groups. And although I really like Eli's Coming, I just really like Easy to Be Hard. I just kind of like that.
Oh, Easy
song,
to Be
you know?
Hard is great. That's from Hair. That's from the musical Hair.
It's just an unbelievable group. They seem to have just, you know, live on even till today. You know,
yeah, no, they're great. I don't think people really, if you weren't around in the early 70s, just how huge Three Dog Night was. I mean, they were massively popular. And, they were great. And I still love listening to Three Dog Night. They're a fantastic group.
And you know what? I think I had some pretty decent seats at the time, if I recall. But, you know, the ticket prices back then, it's hard to imagine how cheap they were, you know? I think I might have paid maybe $15 or so.
Oh, no,
you know?
It's got to be cheaper than that, Tom, because I saw Zeppelin.
Really?
I saw Zeppelin in 1977 for $8.50.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? I was going to say, I know it wasn't more than 15, so it could have been 10 or 12.
It's got to be, yeah.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah, those were the days. All right, Tom, thanks.
Okay, great.
Yeah, the price for a concert ticket in the 70s, like if you went to a big show, like I think it was $6.50 to see Kiss. I mean, it was like $6.50 to see Kiss. It was $8.50 to see Zeppelin. It was, I mean, that's $6.50 to see Tull. I think, you know, the classic Out of the Blue tour with ELO, I think that was $8.50. $8.50. So, incredible. Here's Dan the Snowman. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Nick. How are you, buddy?
All right. What's up?
All right, man. I was at that killer show, that Thin Lizzy Queen. What a show that was.
Oh, man. You're killing me, Dan.
Dude, that was a week after I had seen Kiss with Uriah Heep.
Yeah.
It was insane,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, you know what? I went to the Kiss Uriah Heep show. I've saw Kiss like four or five times when I was a kid. But, man, I don't know. I have no idea how I missed Thin Lizzy and Queen. I mean, how does it? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Oh, dude, it was insane. It was killer. And I just wanted to share that with you because I heard you say it, and boy, my hair stood up on my arm. And I go, yep. I go, I got to call Nick.
I appreciate it.
All right, buddy. Listen, I'm at the airport. I'm going to work at the airport. Have a great day. I'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Take care, buddy. There you go. Dan the Snowman was at that Thin Lizzy Queen concert just calling to rub my nose into it. Hey, Tom.
Yes, sir.
I saw on your little Facebook page there that you're going to see ELO.
That I am. Yeah, that's this weekend, man.
Yeah, man. Let me explain something to you. It's going to be amazing.
I'm freaking out.
I was just saying, I only paid $8.50 to see him in 1977 on that tour.
Yeah, we paid a little bit more for this one.
I bet you did.
I won't lie to you. But you know, it's going to be all the boys from college. We have our dumb little joke about having an ELO cover band.
Yeah.
That's all keyboards. So it's going to be great.
Well,
I love ELO
it.
So much.
You're going to love it, man. That's one of my favorite concerts of all time. I went to the Out of the Blue show for that tour in 1977. It was one of the greatest concerts I've ever seen in my life. And I love ELO. I love that band. So, all right. Some more from 1969. MC5, Kick Out the Jams. What are we talking about here? It might not have been until 1977 when punk rock became somewhat of a household name, but its foundation was set in 1969 in Detroit. The album was recorded live at Detroit's Grand Ballroom, but as the band's later studio albums would prove, it was the only way to capture the restless amp crankers. The band, who was notoriously political for their association with the White Panther Party, kicks the album off with a speech from the crowd and spiritual advisor brother J.C. Crawford. So there you go. How about Leonard Cohen? Songs from a Room.
Ooh.
Great songwriter. So many of Cohen's songs thrive because of their monumental size and lyrical density. The oft-covered Bird on a Wire from Songs from a Room is just the opposite. A few simple lines delivered humbly and... they both please the ear and engage the mind. On the same album, though, the story of Isaac uses a biblical tale as a framing device, but his application of the theme that leads to the way the youth of the 60s were being treated by their elders. Stooges, self-titled album, 1960. Man, this was a good year. The Stooges, although the cards weren't necessarily stacked in their favor, their own label Elektra didn't necessarily believe in them. The only thing that was quiet about the Stooges' 1969 debut was its impact on the Billboard charts. The band's self-titled effort introduced the spastic howling Iggy Pop behind a studio-tamed backing band. Although the album doesn't quite capture the band's bombastic live show, it does showcase their unique and oddly meticulous take on songwriting, best showcased in the sludgy I Want to Be Your Dog. Yeah, the Stooges. Iggy Pop, man. Incredible. And my only question is, does Iggy Pop own a shirt? I don't think Iggy Pop owns a shirt. he did have a shirt on in The Dead Don't Die. He was Iggy Pop Zombie. He was Zombie Iggy Pop in The Dead Don't Die. But he did have a shirt on. But I think in real life, he does not own a shirt. How about this? The Flying Burrito Brothers, Gilded Palace of Sin. There were other albums that set precedent for rock and roots crossover. a sound that would eventually morph into Americana. The band, the Birds, Poco, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band all played roles in that transition, but none as emphatic an impression as this, the debut album from the Flying Burrito Brothers. Several of its members had flown with the Birds, and of course the cosmic cowboy himself, Gram Parsons. What's the name of the movie where they take Gram Parsons' body? It's a true story. It's a true story, but they made a movie out of it where they when they drove around with Gram Parsons' body in the back of a
Grand Theft Parsons.
That's it. Grand Theft. It's an insane story. It's a true story. It's insane, and the movie's pretty damned entertaining.
Starring Johnny Knoxville.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Grand Theft Parsons. Oh, boy. All right. Well, let me take a break here. When we come back, we'll jump back into it. We're talking about the best albums and the best music of 1969 after we celebrated talking about Woodstock 50 years ago. These are some of the music that everybody was listening to. And if you want to, remember maybe some of your concerts, some of your favorite concerts from back in the day. Can't believe Dan went to the Thin Lizzy Queen show. Can you imagine that? Thin Lizzy and Queen. I just can't. I mean, the mind boggles.
I know.
Jeez.
And that kind of thing was like commonplace.
Oh, yeah.
You just get these crazy bills.
Well, what was it? Van Halen opened for someone insane when their first album came out, when Van Halen 1 came out. They toured. I mean, it was incredible. It was like Van Halen was the opening act, and I can't remember who the headliners were, but it was just like, what? So, all right. Let's take a break here, and we'll come back. 312-981-7200 is the phone number of the music of 1969 and concert memories. Give us a call or a text.
Oh, Susie Q. Oh, Susie Q.
Welcome back, everybody. You know what I think of every time I hear this song?
I don't know. Susie Q's like the hostess?
Nope. The Playmates dancing in front of the helicopters in Apocalypse Now.
Oh, yeah.
That's the first.
Oh, wow.
That's what I think of immediately.
No way.
Every time I hear that song.
And me, I'm just thinking of dessert.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and it's the music of 1969 that we are... that we're talking about here. We were talking about Woodstock with someone who is actually at Woodstock. And Great Moments in Vinyl is going to play the music of Woodstock July 25th at the Rialto Square Theater. But now we're talking about the best albums of 1969 and some of your concert memories if you want to jump in with that too. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We're also going to talk about A-listers who actually didn't get famous until after 40. It's happened. That's coming up. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right here on WGN. All right. How about this? Can. Monster movie. Yes, this is the album with the palette-swapped Galactus on the cover. I wouldn't call Monster movie a plant eater, but Can's first album is about as accessible an entry point as you will find in the experimental German band. The droning, noise-drenched take on blues rock is the first side. On the first side is Velvet's influenced in the best way, taking its lead from White Light, White Heat more than anything else. Can was one of my friend's favorite bands of all time.
They're so amazing.
Yeah. How about this? Number 19, 1969, Nick Drake, Five Leaves Left. You want to feel happy? Put on some Nick Drake.
I can't believe how ahead of his time he was in terms of how he sounded.
Yeah.
Because you could put on anything by Nick Drake and you would think that it was a brand new album.
Yeah.
So many artists of today pulling straight from
it. No question about it. Nick Drake was only 21 when he released his debut album, Five Leaves Left. Two albums and 5 years later, Drake had passed on, leaving the world absent of his melancholy lyrics and unique voice. While Drake only needed a guitar to have impact, Five Leaves Left gives him a string arrangement on many tracks like Way to Be Blue and Day Is Gone, making his songs transcendent. Drake wasn't here for long, but Five Leaves Left shows the beginning of a short career filled with music that is astoundingly gorgeous. It's amazing that his career was that short, considering, you know, the kind of impact that he made and makes today. It's incredible that it was only a couple of years.
I think I was watching, you know, I'm making my way through Gilmore Girls right now.
Yeah.
And they reference Nick Drake like a lot.
Yes, they do. Well, they reference a lot of stuff a lot.
True. Gilmore but Girls. Like, it's so weird how I'm watching this show, and this is from the first season is like 2000, right?
2000 was the first season, was 2000.
And I'm just like, man, if I had met a girl like Rory.
Oh, man, please.
When I was a teenager, I would flip out.
Yeah.
I'd be in love.
Oh, yeah.
Especially, she'd be like, oh, man, she listens to all that cool music, and her friend has to keep all her CDs underneath the floorboards.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's funny, you know, that show, one of the reasons why I love that show so much, besides the fact that it's just the characters are just so completely lovable and really you really root for them and you really love them. And the setting, I want, as I mentioned this before, I want Stars Hollow to be real. I would love to live in Stars Hollow and have coffee at Luke's. I don't even drink coffee, but I'd go in and have coffee at Luke's. But you know, Amy Sherman Palladino and Daniel Palladino, their writing is just so great. And it's loaded. You know, you mentioned Nick Drake, but there are pop culture references that just fly.
Yeah.
Constantly.
It's blink and you miss.
Yeah. I mean, there's tons of stuff. And it's just the writing style of Amy Sherman Palladino. And it's written and it's acted in a way that is really old school. Like the way that, you know, that they would deliver lines in the 30s and 40s in movies.
Yeah, I thought I was watching a scene. I was like, "This is His Girl Friday."
Well, yeah,
right here.
And His Girl Friday is one. I think one of the greatest movies ever made in the history of film. It's one of the greatest movies ever made, and I can watch it. If there was a 24-hour His Girl Friday network, I would just have it on. I love that movie. My love for that movie is immeasurable. And I think it was a movie that really, when I was directing comedy plays for the Factory Theater, it was a movie that completely influenced my directorial style. There are times when you watch His Girl Friday, at least when I watch His Girl Friday, and I'm out of breath, like after a scene, I'm just like, what? Most exquisitely timed comedy of all time.
Did people in the 40s just talk faster?
I mean, it's just crazy, crazy good. But yeah, and it's clearly influenced, you know, Amy Sherman Palladino's directing and writing. There's no question about it. But man, you know, Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell in that movie. Oh my God.
The bit with the boyfriend and the old man, I think, is
Ralph Bellamy. That's
so
Ralph
funny.
Well, it's because he goes up to the old man and says, like, how you doing? Nice to meet you. And it's Ralph Bellamy. But the other thing that's really funny is that he, you know, before when he's trying to, you know, get Ralph Bellamy to like get thrown in jail, where he's going to throw him in jail so that he can get Rosalind Russell back out on the story. He goes, tells the guy that's working, for him that's going to go take, you know, the going to take the wallet. Ralph, he goes, I want you to go outside there and I'm not going to try and do a Cary Grant because it would be embarrassing. But he says, go out there and get this guy. He looks a little bit like that actor, Ralph Bellamy. And of course, it is Ralph Bellamy. And he, I can't remember the exact line, but he mentions, of course, last time I had a problem like this, it was with my friend Archie Leach. And that's Cary Grant's real name, is Archibald Leach. I'm surprised he changed it.
I know. That's what I never got. That Cary, I guess Cary Grant is more dashing. But...
I guess Archibald Leach. That's his name. That's Cary Grant's real name. One of my favorite actors of all time, Cary Grant, man. I mean, the guy could do anything. He could do anything. God, I loved him. He was the best. Absolutely the best. Okay, let's take a break here on WGN. We got a lot more albums from 1969 to talk about. We're talking music as well. Two for Tuesday.
Yeah!
312-981-7200. And we want to hear from you about concert memories and music from 69 and all that cool stuff. More coming up after this. That's right. terrible movie, great song. You ever see the movie FM?
I did. I don't mind it.
Oh, come on, really?
Yeah, I don't mind it.
Oh, man.
I don't mind it.
Great soundtrack. Great soundtrack. And
maybe that's why.
The title track is amazing. Steely Dan. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the All State Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on a Tuesday morning. Two for Tuesday. Yeah, man, two for Tuesday. Who's got the good taste for requesting the Dan?
That's coming to us from Steve in Galesburg.
All right, Steve in Galesburg. You get another Steely Dan song coming up. It's Two for Tuesday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're going through this list of great albums from 1969, and we're on number 18. Frank Zappa, Hot Rats. Vic, have you heard Frank Zappa, Hot Rats?
No, but wasn't Frank Zappa involved in that, what was that album, Tom, that you had to help me on?
Captain Beefheart.
Wasn't he involved in that? Wasn't he in that studio session?
He probably was, yeah. Here's the thing. Yeah, Frank Zappa's involved in that, absolutely. Yeah. And by the way, I just wanted to let you know, Vic, Captain Beefheart, Trout Mask Replica.
No.
Number 10 on this list. Number 10 on the list of the best albums of 1969.
I haven't listened to that, re-listened to that yet again, but I'm going to until I like it.
So you like it? I think it might take a long time.
Or at least get it.
Yeah, it might take a long time. I thought it was so funny when I walked into the newsroom. What are you listening to now? And you showed me the cover, and I was like, oh, man.
That's by far the most bizarre album I've ever listened to.
Well, you should listen to Hot Rats.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Is this the one you're talking about?
That's Frank Zappa, yeah.
Wow.
Frank Zappa's Hot Rats came out the same year.
You know what, though? I mean, if I was, in the room watching this, I think I'd totally love it.
It would be really interesting to see,
yeah.
You know, like the sessions for those records.
Right.
Number 17 on the list is Crosby, Stills, and Nash first record. The self-titled debut album from the supergroup made up of former members of the Byrds, Buffalo Springfield, and the Hollies starts with the flooring and intricate harmonies of Sweet Judy Blue Eyes and doesn't let up. While their musicianship, blending the rootsy sounds of blues, jazz, country, and folk, is undeniable, Crosby, Stills, and Nash legacy is also heavily politically vibrant. There you go. The first Crosby, Stills, and Nash record, 1969. Man, what a strong year. 804 Rasco says, I hope Dylan's Nashville Skyline is on the 1969 list. Album made it to number one in the U.S. and the U.K. that year. Dylan's appearance on Johnny Cash's show was also memorable. 519 area code says, I was fortunate enough to see Frank Zappa in Montreal. I saw Zappa in 1988. A friend of mine had an extra ticket. I had never, I've never been a huge Zappa fan. I admire the guy, especially when he was, when the Tipper Gore thing was happening, and I thought he was a brilliant dude. But it's just not my, Zappa's just not my scene. I mean, I think the guy was a musical genius. He was unbelievable instrumentalist. No question about it. It just was not my
deal. I think he has the best album title I've ever heard.
Which?
Shake Your Booty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He had a great sense of humor, man. He had a great Don't Eat the Yellow Snow.
Yeah, yeah.
It was one of his songs. So my friend is like, yeah, I got an extra ticket. Why don't you just come with me and see Zappa? And I'm like, all right. So the night before, I had gone to see my second night. I saw two nights of Sting. He was on tour for one of my favorite albums of all time, Nothing Like the Sun, which is one of the greatest albums ever recorded in the history of anything. And so I went to two nights of Sting, and then the next night, my friend's like, listen, just come see Zappa. You don't have to buy the ticket. Just come with me. So it was at the Auditorium Theater down here, downtown. We go, and it was his band was amazing. The musicianship on stage was insane. When he conducted his band, it was extraordinary to watch. And then he says, I would like to introduce a special guest, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Sting. And then Sting came out, and I lost my mind, and they did Murder by Numbers. And I was just like beside my, but he introduced him as Mr. Sting.
What so, else are you going
to
call him?
So, now, you know, I mean, I went to both nights of Sting. He was playing at the UIC Pavilion. So I went to both nights of Sting, and then I'm like, all right, on a lark, I go see Zappa, and Mr. Sting shows up. And they do Murder by Numbers with the entire orchestra. It was fantastic. It was a really good show. Just besides Sting showing up, I was really like, wow. I mean, I understand why people really, really, really get into Zappa. So, all right, how about this? 1969, Isaac Hayes, Hot Buttered Soul.
Yeah.
You don't mess around.
Not with Chef.
You don't mess around with Chef, man. One of the best and most grandiose soul albums ever recorded, Hot Buttered Soul, made Isaac Hayes a superstar and changed the face of black pop music for the next decade. Then a prominent songwriter and backing musician at Stax, Hayes was fascinated by traditional songcraft and drawn to the works of Burt Bacharach and Hal David, whose Walk On By opens this 1969 album. Rather than heed the song's concise, compact charms, Hayes explodes it from the center, turning it into a symphonic ballad, and then a tight jam with the Bar Kays. And he covers By the Time I Get to Phoenix, Jimmy Webb, one of the greatest songwriters of all time. And By the Time I Get to Phoenix is a great song, and he does a great job with it. Yeah, Isaac Hayes, man. If you want to see something fantastic. Now, you know, when they perform the best song categories at the Academy Awards, especially over the years, it's always just, like, very stodgy,
mm-hmm.
you know, or they do some really lame dance number.
Yeah, the only really great one I can think of recent note, and that would be Jennifer Hudson, but that was back when Dreamgirls came out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Amy Mann did Save Me at the Academy Awards.
Cause that's true.
It was nominated for Best Song.
I was also 6 years old.
Robin Williams did Blame Canada, because Blame Canada was nominated for Best Song, even though the up there, the song that performed by the Devil, that should have been nominated. All of the songs in that Uncle Something, I can't say it on the air, but that is, I mean, I, you know, we've talked about this before. I can't tell you how much I love South Park Bigger, Longer, Uncut. I think it's one of the greatest movie musicals of all time. I mean, I really do. And I mean that sincerely. But anyway, if you want to see something fantastic, go back to the 1971 Oscars or 72 Oscars and watch Isaac Hayes' performance of Shaft. It's unbelievably awesome. He's wearing like he's wearing like a chain link shirt, like a shirt. It's just chains. Got the backup dancers with the giant froze. It's smoke all over the place. And when they cut to the audience, it's like, huh? Like, people are like, what is happening? Because, you know, like, that's like they mentioned, like, Burt Bacharach and stuff like that. That's the kind of stuff that you would see performed in very straightforward tuxedo clad guys. And here's Isaac Hayes out there, sunglasses on, bald, shiny head, crazy chain shirt, singing Shaft. It's one of the greatest musical performances in Oscar history. Isaac Hayes. 15 on the list, Fairport Convention. 1969 was a very good year for Fairport Convention's long and still active history. They welcomed vocalist Sandy Denny into the fold, and of course the masterful work of Richard Thompson. So, how about this? David Bowie, Space Oddity. Bowie's 1969 album Space Oddity would be the record that transitioned him from his early music to the 70s Bowie, who established the essence of glam rock. Bowie's folk rock sound at this time provided a humble platform for his unmistakable vocals, and his commentary about the politics and climate of the era are apparent, displaying his maturation as a musician and a visionary. This album is a staple in the musical history of the 60s. Yeah, that was that's the album that, like, that established him and put him on the course to pretty much dominate that kind of stuff in the 70s.
Because he had that was his third album?
Third, I think, yeah.
Yeah, because he had had the self-titled, which was, like, not really much of a splash.
Yeah.
Man Who Sold the World, and then this.
This, yeah. And then, you know, I loved, you know, the thing about Bowie, and we can, you know, this is an obvious thing, but it was amazing how he was able to stay current, like to be on top of everything that was happening in the following decades. You know?
He did it all.
everything. Like, and he always fit in. He was never, like, out of style. I mean, come on, man. Let's Dance in the 80s? Come on. No one was cooler.
Yeah.
No one was cooler.
He even did, like, 90s kind of, like, electronic
music.
When
he hooked up with Nine Inch Nails, man.
Yeah, that's...
I'm Afraid of Americans?
That is straight up the weirdest tour I've ever heard of. I've ever heard of. David Bowie and Nine Inch Nails?
And it works. It works.
It so works.
Yeah.
It's just shocking that now,
The song at the end of Seven, with the end credits of Seven. I mean, that sounded as vital in 1995 as anything did. No, he was the man, and I know that I'm stating the obvious, and he was taken from us way too soon. Because we had Bowie and Prince, wasn't it like sort of back to back?
Well, because I remember it kicked off in December of 2015.
Lemmy died
in December. Bowie died in, I want to say, February, and then Prince was...
Spring.
It was like, I want to say April.
Yeah, it was April, because everybody was talking about Sometimes It Snows in April.
Yep.
And D'Angelo played that on The Tonight Show. But yeah, no, I mean, Bowie was... He was amazing. Absolutely amazing how he adjusted to the times, and he was ahead of it. And Space Oddity came out in 1969, and from that point on, man, you know, his career took off, and he was one of the most important musical artists of all time. So, okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we got more 1969 albums to talk about. Some really great stuff came out that year, and if you want to share some memories about music or share some memories about concerts that you've seen, jump in here, 312-981-7200. A song attributing to, you know, a tribute to 19-year-old women, tequila and pot. Steely Dan.
The three things you need.
I love that band so much, man. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Two for Tuesday. Yeah, man, two for Tuesday. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. We were talking about some of the best albums of 1969. We were talking about one of the monumental occasions from 1969, and that would be Woodstock. And now we're continuing to talk about music from that year. And also some of our concert memories, if you want to jump in at 312-981-7200. Here's Michael on WGN. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
All right. What's up?
Hey, now, when they're talking about the, you know, it's 69, and you're talking about the deaths of Bowie, Prince, and then Lemmy, brought Lemmy up. His first album was in 69 with Sam Gepal's Escalator.
Wow.
It's a pretty heavy album, actually.
Well, I would expect nothing less from Lemmy, so.
Oh, well, he didn't go by Lemmy Kilmister, because I don't believe he changed his name till, like, I think a Hawkwind album back in 70. Warriors at the Edge of Time.
Yeah.
Lemmy Kilmister's last album with Hawkwind, and that's another great album. And actually, there's a song called Motorhead on that album.
Right.
The very last song.
Right.
But, you know, it's I left my glasses at home, so I can't text. But I'm actually driving, too. So, but there was a couple of things I wanted to bring up about 69. You brought that Fairport Convention album.
Right.
That's the Legion Leaf album.
Right.
I listen to that constantly because it's a great album. I think Sandy Denny's got a great voice.
Right.
It's a shame she left us in 77. But also in 69, there was a band called Pentangle, another folk rock, well, actually a folk jazz band.
Right.
Their first album was in 69, and that's pretty good, too. Sandy Denny and Pentangle both do a song called Brudentown. Very different from each other, but equally great, each version.
All right. All right, Michael, thanks for the call, man.
Okay, they better have Blind Skates album on there for 69.
All right. All right, Michael, we'll find out. Take care. There we go. Coming in at number 13, Dusty Springfield, Dusty in Memphis.
Of course.
Classic. Her 1969 magnum opus, The English Soul Queen, hopped across the pond, recording with Memphis producers Jerry Wexler, Tom Dowd, and Arif Martin, singing tracks penned by heavyweights like Randy Newman, which is I Don't Want to Hear It Anymore and Just One Smile, and Carole King, So Much Love and Don't Forget About Me. But the album's crown jewel is, of course, the classic Son of a Preacher Man, which is such a great song.
That's a sultry song.
It's a great, great song. Number 12, Velvet Underground. The Velvet Underground's third effort is their first to feature Doug Ewell. In addition to playing bass, Ewell handles lead vocals on Candy Says, the album's opening ode to Candy Darling, who would later be the subject of Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side. The album marks a departure for the art rockers as they begin to shift from their experimental Warhol years to calmer, mellower, and no less outstanding sonic territory. Number 11, Tommy by The Who. Now, I know Vic listened to this one. On 1967's excellent The Who Sell Out, guitarist-composer Pete Townsend attempted his first concept album, a fake radio broadcast which blended original acid rock tracks with brief, silly commercial jingle interludes. The concept, quote-unquote, of course, was just cutesy fluff. Nobody was likely prepared for the band's sprawling 1969 rock opera Tommy, which, in slightly confusion fashion, chronicles the rise of a deaf, dumb, and blind pinball-playing child abuse victim who finds fame and literal cult following after being cured by a smashed mirror or something like that. While Tommy's borderline silly narrative nearly ODs on hippie-fried Summer of Love excess, the music is simply majestic. From the psych-pop gems like Amazing Journey in the Acid Queen to classic rock anthems like I'm Free, We're Not Gonna Take It, and the legendary Pinball Wizard. And then ended up being one of the craziest Ken Russell movies ever. Featuring the incredible vocal stylings of Oliver Reed. I love that movie.
I watched it, I think, when I was 12 and just had no idea what the hell was. I was like, oh, yeah, The Who. They're cool.
Yeah.
They've got T-shirts at Kohl's.
Yeah.
And I watched it, and I was just like, so this is what my parents warned me about when taking drugs.
Well, Ken Russell is nuts, you know.
Well, now I appreciate it as, like, a genuine work of art.
Oh, it's insane.
But when I was 12, I'm like, can't be good.
I was 11 when it came out.
Jeez.
And I saw it in the theater, 70 millimeter at the State Lake Theater. Insane, crazy sound. And I was familiar with the record because even at that age, you know, I was a rock guy. I started listening to music at really, really young. Well, as you know, I was like 8 when I bought Paranoid at the record store, and then I didn't look back. So by the time, you know, the movie came out, I was very familiar with the album, but not the versions that they did, you know, like having the actors and all that stuff sing. My dad's favorite scene is the Eric Clapton number. That's my dad's favorite part of the whole movie. I remember my dad going nuts when we saw it.
I mean, it's an awesome scene.
I like Anne Margaret rolling around in beans. I don't care. That's my favorite scene in the entire movie, is the TV exploding and the beans flying out all over the beautiful, and Anne Margaret at the height of her hotness in that movie.
Anne Margaret rolling around
in beans and soap.
Whoever thought that would be a sentence you would use in your lifetime?
I remember, you know, I was 11, and I was like, ooh, I didn't know what was happening.
Then
was happening, and I was like, oh, I don't know what's going on here.
Every time you saw a tin of Bush's beans, you got a little hot under the
collar.
What's
going on here, man? Oliver Reed is one of my favorites. I love Oliver Reed. I always did. And I've told you about the book Hellraisers, right? One of the greatest books ever. Richard Harris, Peter O'Toole, Richard Burton, Oliver Reed. It's the great. I've read it 3 times. It is a spectacular book.
Bunch of drunks with a sobriety problem.
God. I mean, Peter O'Toole and Richard Harris were in a pub and they were trying to close down, so they bought it.
What a move.
And they wake up the next day, they're like, you know, I think we bought a pub. So they went back down to the pub, and the owner was like, it's all right, and he tore up the contract.
That just blows my mind.
They just wouldn't leave. They would not leave. The bartender was like, look, we're closed. You got to go. We'll buy it. We'll buy the pub.
Sure thing, Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy my pub. My God.
Yeah. Oh, and the Oliver Reed stories. Oh, good Lord. Maniac. Oh, speaking of which, this is coincidental. I mean, he was best friends with Keith Moon, which is why, you know, I think why he was cast in the movie. And then can you imagine those two guys, like, out on the town, like Keith Moon and Oliver Reed?
I'd just bring a tranquilizer gun.
Whipping bar stools through windows for no reason. It's like, get out of the way. Here comes Keith Moon and Oliver Reed. Everybody leave. All right, we got a break here for the news, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the music from 1969, some of the best music of 69, and maybe some of your concert experiences. And if you want to jump in here with talk or text, we'd love to hear from you at 312-981-7200.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born.
I hate this band. Two for Tuesday. Yeah, man, Two for Tuesday. The Stupid Doors. Who requested the Stupid Doors?
That's coming to us from John in Decatur. Right, who made John. an excellent choice.
Oh, God.
Love him.
Biggest buffoon frontman in the history of rock.
And that's not David Lee Roth.
He's a great frontman. David Lee Roth is a fantastic frontman. Jim Morrison was a buffoon. I remember in high school they made like a resurgence, like a big comeback.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember he was on the cover of Rolling Stone. Like Jim Morrison was on the cover of Rolling Stone. It was 1981. He died in 1970. So 11 years after his death, they start making a comeback. And I remember all of my friends in high school. Yeah, man, the Doors. Like, shut up.
Oh, my mom loved the Doors. Ugh. She still loves the Doors.
God.
Especially Riders on the Storm.
I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't even remotely.
Hey, man, I'm the Lizard King, man.
Oh, shut up. And of course Oliver Stone makes a movie. Of course.
Val Kilmer, man.
Val Kilmer, who would not answer to anything but either Lizard King or Jim during the making of the movie. Idiot.
Oh, but when Daniel Day-Lewis does it, it's art.
It is. Because he's not playing Jim Morrison. He's not playing a buffoon. Yeah, no, I don't, you know, and the whole like, oh man, he's a poet, man. No, he's not. He's a drunk.
A lot of drunks were poets. Yeah, and a lot of poets were drunks.
The poet part wasn't really part of it. The drunk part was fantastic. He was really great at that. What is it, Dennis Leary said? We need a 3-hour movie about Jim Morrison. I can sum it up for you. I'm drunk. I'm famous. I'm drunk. I'm drunk. I'm no one. I'm drunk. I'm famous. I'm drunk. I'm dead. Or I'm drunk. I'm fat. I'm drunk. I'm dead.
He did put on some weight.
Yeah.
He put on a little weight.
Yes, he did. Yeah, no, I mean, I know I'm in the minority. I know a lot of people love the Doors. I just don't get it, man. I just don't get it. I'm trying to think if there's any other songs. Are there any songs I like? The song that everybody hates. That all the Doors fans hate. Because of the orchestra. Dun, 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 dun,
oh
dun,
wait!
Dun,
oh, Touch Me?
Yeah,
that's it. No, I love that. I think that's a
people
great
hate that. Doors fans hate that song.
That's because they're not real fans, yeah. Man.
That's the only song I like by them.
Touch Me, Babe.
But I don't like the vocals. That's the other problem. And I like that. I like the arrangement. I like the song. I like the horns and everything on it. I just don't like Jim Morrison. He just makes me nuts, man. I can't listen to his vocals without going, why don't you shut up?
I'm going to have to go to the nearest Spencer's Gifts and get like a nice big black light
poster of
Jim Morrison, and I'll put on my side of the office,
God
and I'll make you look at it.
I can't even. Yeah. I've tried, man.
I know.
But, I mean, I'm a classic rock guy. I grew up on that stuff.
Sure.
And
hey, man, they're not Zeppelin.
They shouldn't even be said in the same sentence. Yeah, I had a, you know, when I first started having a radio show, regular radio show here on WGN, you know, I had already been reviewing movies, obviously, for many years with Roy Leonard on his show and appeared on other people's shows as well. But when I first got my own show, they teamed me up with a guy named Gary Lee Wright. Terrific guy. Great radio talent, great personality. Was a morning drive for many years on XRT. And they teamed me up with Gary, and we had the Nick D and Gary Lee show, which had years of success. We were great partners together, and we worked really well together. And the amazing thing about that, because I loved working with Gary, and we had a really incredible rapport, we did not meet until the first night we got on air.
Are you serious?
Absolutely.
Oh, that was fate.
We met an hour and a half before the first time we ever went on air. That was the first time we ever met. Mary June Rose, who was our program director at the time back in the like 98 when this happened, she said, I think there's something about the two of you, because she wanted to, you know, Roy was retiring. Roy had announced that he was going to retire. Mm. Well, he didn't announce it yet, but he told me and he told, you know, close friends and obvious management
right.
that he was retiring. He was retiring at the end of 1998. He retired in December of 1998 and told me in April and told the station in April. And so obviously, we kept it under our hats until the official announcement. Roy would make the official announcement, but they wanted to make some moves. So Mary June called me into her office and said, "We want to keep you. You know, we want to keep you doing what you're doing, even though Roy's retiring." I was like, "Oh God, thank God! You know, thank you. I'm so
my
I'm
bank
so
account
grateful.
Thanks you."
She's like, "Whoever is taking over on the Saturday show, Roy's Saturday show, you will still do your movie review segment with them." And I was like, "Oh, that's awesome!" And she goes, "And I think I want to test you out on your own show. But I'm not going to have you do it alone because I don't trust you." That's exactly what she said to me. And so she's like, "I'm going to team you up with this guy named Gary Lee Wright, who's got experience, who will show you things, and who could probably pull back your idiotic personality a little bit," which he did. He tempered me.
Yeah.
He tempered me. And she was completely honest. She was a fan of mine, but I would go too far a lot of times. And I would fully
honesty
admit that.
Honesty is honesty.
When I was on this radio station in my 20s, I was an annoying smartass. There's no question about it.
You? No way.
There's no question about it. You know, and I can understand why listeners wanted to punch me square in the mouth. There's no, I see that now. I look back at that and I go, man, what a jerk. What a young jerk who had no business being on this legendary radio station. And I totally understand why people were negative to me when I first started. I totally understand that now. You know, the age of wisdom, man. Wisdom, you know, wisdom comes with age. So they teamed me up with Gary, and Gary and I met an hour and a half before we first went on the air. We went on the air, and we found out we had a lot in common. He was left-handed. I was left-handed. We both did not like Robin Williams. And we found other things. But the one thing that we were completely on the opposite, and the reason I bring this up, and I know this is a long, winding, stupid story, but the one thing that we were completely opposite on, The Doors.
He liked The Doors.
He was a massive Doors fan. He loved The Doors, and he loved Jim Morrison. And so that was like the one thing where we did not click. Because otherwise, our personalities, it was really weird. Because I never met the guy before, and he's 10 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also a really cool thing, because it was a generational thing that was happening.
Right, right.
And so, you know, like I was like, when we first started together, I was in my early 30s when we first started together. And I had mellowed out a little bit on the air, but I learned a lot from him. It was great working with Gary. It was great. And we worked together for about 6 years. We had a show together, and I had, you know, a solo show on Friday and on Sunday, but we were Saturday. We would work together. But anyway, so that was the one thing that we would never want to bring up is the difference between
is the Doors.
Like he was a massive Doors fan. And that was the only conflict we ever had. Was when we worked together was over Jim Morrison and the Doors.
Of course.
Okay, we're at number 10. Number 10 is Vic's favorite album. That would be Trout Mask Replica by Captain Beefheart.
Amazing.
He's going to get a Trout
fake
Mask
Replica. Fake news.
he's going to get a Trout Mask Replica album cover tattoo is what I heard.
I'm not kidding. I might go out and just get him a bunch of Beefheart memorabilia. I'll wear it.
Oh, man. Number 9, Miles Davis, In a Silent Way. Though a far cry from the seminal Kind of Blue, it's just as transportive. So Miles Davis making it with, it's a polarizing album, though. A lot of people go cold on that one. Did you have any Miles Davis on your list, Vic?
Yes, one. I did have one.
Was it
that one that I listened to on a Saturday morning?
Oh, right.
While doing laundry.
Oh, right.
Not the right time to listen to Miles Davis.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
It was heavy for a Saturday morning.
And
yeah.
It was Kind of Blue, right? Was that the one that you listened to?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, here's another one I believe, Vic, that you listened to. King Crimson and the Court of the Crimson King.
No.
Oh, you didn't listen to that?
No,
oh, man.
Wait a minute. That's got to be on the list, though, right?
What is it again?
King Crimson in the Court of the Crimson King. One of the greatest album covers of all time, by the way.
Well, I got to Google it.
No, I think it's got to be on that list. It's got to be on the top
one. It's not on the top 100 unless it's in the top 25.
Well, it's got to be. Well, then you know what? It is in the top 20. There's no question that it's in the top 25.
Robert Fripp's guitar alone.
Give it to me again.
King Crimson.
King Crimson.
In the Court of the Crimson King. One of the most iconic album covers. Okay, one of my favorite album covers of all time.
Oh, yeah, that's a cool album. No, I have. That's not on the top 100.
No, okay, that's wrong. No. Hold on. Call Rolling Stone right now. Get Jan Weiner on the phone now. Get him on the phone right now. How in God's name is Court of the Crimson King not on the top 100 albums of all time? How is that even possible?
I'm glad this came up because I'll listen to it this weekend. I'll do a little extra credit work.
My God.
It's such an iconic album that even Kanye West samples it. He sampled it for a song. Like, it's that good of an album.
It's also in Children of Men.
Yeah.
Brilliantly used in Children of Men. Because Alfonso Cuarón is a prog rock maniac. So, like, he plays King Crimson on the way to meeting Danny Houston when Clive Owen is meeting Danny Houston. And as they stand outside the window, the big pig from Animals, from Pink Floyd Animals, is floating outside. When I saw that, I was like, Alfonso Cuarón is the king of the universe. Here's King Crimson on the way to meet this guy. And then there's the album cover for Pink Floyd Animals recreated in this movie. I was like, this is just fantastic. And on top of that, it's one of the greatest movies ever. I love that movie. Man, oh, man. I saw that movie in the theater like 13 times. I adore that movie. It was my favorite movie of the aughts. You know, I got to do that. I got to do the 10s. Mm-hmm. Oh.
This will be a fun December.
Yeah. We'll get Eric and Steve down here live. We'll do our top 10. We'll do the top 10 of 2019, and we'll have them come back the next week, and we'll do the whole decade.
Well, I will say that IndieWire did release their top 100 of it. So I would say a little jump in the gun here.
We're only halfway through the year.
But they released their top 100 films of the decade.
I got to think about it, man.
Yeah, no.
Well, I don't have to think about it. It's Fury Road.
Yeah,
it's Fury Road. It's Fury Road. Fury Road's the best movie of the decade. I don't even know. Seriously,
it's going to be the other nine.
It's the other nine, or you know, I mean, I'll probably do 25. You know,
Soon.
But it's the other ones I got to be concerned about. But I already know what the number one movie of the decade is, and that's it's Fury Road.
We'll send a certificate to George Miller.
Just don't even. I don't even need to think about it. Like, man, what am I going to put at number one? Ooh, you know when I knew this? You know when I knew that it was the best film of the decade? May 25th, 2015. That's when I knew. it was the best film of the decade. So, all right, let's break here, and then we'll wrap up the conversation about the best music of 1969, and Vic will do an interpretive dance to Captain Beefheart.
We'll get him a trout mask.
Time, baby. Love me twice today. Love me two time, girl. I'm gone away. Love me two time, girl. One for tomorrow.
Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6. And by the way, I'm going to be sitting in for the first hour of the Steve Cochran Show. We're doing headshots this morning. We are all taking, everybody here is taking a new headshot that we're going to put up on the websites and have officially. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be taking our pictures, you know, me and Vic and Tom after 7. So Cochran was like, come on and sit in on the show. So I'm going to be on the first hour of Cochran Show, 6 to 7. And then I'm going to get my picture taken, which I hate more than anything in the world.
Maybe you guys will talk about the Doors.
Oh, God, please. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I am not a fan of having my picture taken at all.
You're like the Amish.
Yes, I'm like the Amish. That's what it is. By the way, coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. But yeah, I'm not a fan. So, but anyway, we'll do it. Hey, you remember that that text a little bit earlier from Rasko?
Mm-hmm.
Here you go, buddy. Bob Dylan, Nashville Skyline.
There it is.
There it is. Bob Dylan is this was his 9th studio album. He took on the role of country crooner. And though he's more often heralded for his influential folk discography and stature as a cultural figure, when Dylan decided to make a country album, he decided to do it right. Like any great record, Nashville Skyline is the perfect amount of twang, stomp, weepiness, and longing. There's a bunch of songs on there. I threw it all away. And then you've got Lay Lady Lay, which is that's actually, and I know this is weird, but Lay Lady Lay is actually one of my favorite Bob Dylan songs of all time. The original studio version of it. I love that song. And I know it's a lot of people, you know, kind of not as crazy about that direction that Bob Dylan went into and not as crazy about that song. That's absolutely, truly one of my favorite Bob Dylan songs is Lay Lady Lay. Johnny Cash did a duet with him on Girl from the North Country. And the songs on Nashville may have been less sonically urgent, but during this time, Dylan himself remained an American symbol as political turmoil continued to swarm in the aftermath of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, Richard Nixon's inauguration in early 1969, and raging on of the Vietnam War. So, but Lay Lady Lay, I love that song. I remember my dad had it, a 45 of it, and I used to listen to it on my little record player. I had one of those little record players that you open up, had a lid on it. I had one of those little record players when I was a little kid, and I used to listen to Lay Lady Lay all the time. It's still one of my favorite Dylan songs. Number 6 is The Band, and that's another album, actually, that Vic listened to and I know really enjoyed. That's the original Band. And now, see, number 5 here, Led Zeppelin 2, which is my favorite Zeppelin album of all time. It was recorded while they were on the road, and it was put together very quickly. But the thing about it is that it really, for my money, kind of shows all the things that Zeppelin can do, like how versatile a band they are. Because there are some heavy songs on here, there's some blues numbers on here, there's acoustic. It's great. There's a song with a 3.5-minute drum solo on it. But stuff like Whole Lot of Love, obviously, Heartbreaker, Livin' Lovin', Ramble On. But my favorite Zeppelin song of all time is What Is and What Should Never Be, which is, I think, a perfect song. And that's on Zeppelin too. Neil Young, everybody knows This Is Nowhere. Please. Neil Young, for me, one of my favorite artists of all time, one of the greatest songwriters ever. You got Down by the River, Cowgirl in the Sand, Cinnamon Girl. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's all on one record. And by the way, the greatest hits package of all time is Neil Young Decade.
Yeah.
It's the best. It is unbelievable. It's a triple album or a double album?
It's triple album. Yeah. It's big.
Decade. They truly, up until that point in his career, it was the best stuff he ever did. Mm-hmm. And they put it all in one place. It's the best greatest hits album of all time. Number 3, Sly and the Family Stone, Stand.
Yeah.
Classic, legendary record. And Richard slept through Sly and the Family Stone at Woodstock. Now, see, this is interesting to me that number 2 is Abbey Road. The Beatles' Abbey Road is number 2 on this list.
Well, when I hear what number 1 is, then I'll save my judgment. I'll see what my judgment is.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. I agree with this because the album at number 1 I like more than Abbey Road. And I love Abbey Road.
Uh-huh.
I love it. It's great. It's a classic album. Clearly, I'm stating the absolute obvious.
Right.
But according to this, number 1 is Let It Bleed by the Stones. And I like Let It Bleed more than Abbey Road.
I'm going to say this. I generally like the Stones more than I like the Beatles.
Yeah.
But I don't think I like Let It Bleed better than I like Abbey Road.
I don't like Let It Bleed more than either Revolver or Rubber Soul.
But you definitely like it.
But I like it more than Abbey Road.
Okay.
Let It Bleed's my favorite. That's my favorite Stones album. I just think it's phenomenal.
Well, it's just like you're choosing between two of the greatest albums ever recorded.
Yeah.
You know, it's an embarrassment of riches.
It is. And I know that Vic liked Let It Bleed. That was one that he was listening to. And it's got my favorite stuff. When we talked about it,
yeah, we played
Vic's picks, yeah. It's my favorite Stone song is on that album too, mm-hmm. which is Live With Me, which is still to this day one of the greatest, if not the greatest, bass line ever.
Mm-hmm.
Like a driving bass line. I love that song. I think it's a great record. Can't Always Get What You Want is on it.
Yeah.
So many great songs. So that's according to Paste, Abbey Road is narrowly defeated by Let It Bleed.
So. By the Strolling Bones.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, listen, here's the deal. We're going to break. We got the news coming up next. And then afterwards, we're going to talk about people who got a late start to their stardom. A-listers who actually didn't really hit it until after 40. And there's an incredible amount of unbelievably talented people who belong on that list. And we'll talk about them. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6. And I'll be hanging out with Steve and the gang between 6 and 7 this morning. So I'm very happy to be a part of it. So that'll be good. Two for Tuesday.
You mean two for Tuesday?
312-981-7200. One artist, two songs. All right. Kenny Loggins. Mm-hmm. What's the deal?
What's the deal? Yeah. That's from our good pal Ike.
Yeah,
wanted to hear some Kenny Loggins for the announcement that, or rather, the release of that trailer for Top Gun Maverick.
God. Yeah,
you have to admit the world seems a little excited. They've always wanted to see a sequel 30 years later to Top Gun.
Yeah, I didn't. I don't need a sequel to Top Gun. I'm perfectly fine.
The trailer didn't take your breath away?
Oh, please. What are you doing here, Henny Youngman? No. You know what? In the trailer, every single thing in the trailer happened in the first movie. It's the same movie. I mean, from what I can tell, it's exactly the same movie. Except that we're going to be like, wow, Tom Cruise is 56 years old and he looks fantastic. Or 57. Whatever he is. 56. 57. So he looks fantastic. But other than that, it looks exactly the same. Exactly.
It'll be fun. We'll get Mission Impossible 7 soon enough.
Yeah, well, please. I'll take that. Mission Impossible movies are awesome.
They are.
I don't care about Top Gun. I just... Nah. Top Gun. Such a stupid movie. brother.
Like I said, I'm still not sure what that movie's about.
It's about nothing. Remember. I don't know. Is he going to be, because he's still a smart-ass guy, Maverick.
Yeah.
But he did not learn his lesson? Because that's what the whole movie's about, is about him learning his lesson.
Mm-hmm.
About being rogue, Maverick.
Yeah, and I don't know how he could get to that age without, like, there's a forced age of retirement. You can't be in the Air Force past a certain age and still be flying.
Navy.
Or Navy.
Naval aviator.
Navalator.
Is there a, Vic, is there an age limit in the Navy?
He's way under that if there is. He's not that old in the movie.
There's not a mandatory age of retirement?
I'm sure there is, but I don't
think he's 57.
Yeah, no, you could still serve, heck yeah.
But could he be a pilot?
Yeah, I mean, I know there's, I mean, I was young when I was in active duty, but there was certainly some generals that looked older than 57 that were serving.
Are they pilots?
Oh, you mean for pilot? Yeah, sure, I'm sure that they still fly, yeah. I don't know the exact rules, but I wouldn't think that they would,
well, not that I'm,
you know, take your wings if you're 57. I don't think so.
I'm not 100% sure. I'm not going to see Top Gun for its accuracy. I don't, you know what I mean?
Exactly. Don't ever watch a military movie.
Top Gun is not,
with
I mean.
Me. Because you can't get through one without me blabbing about all the mistakes.
Wait, Vic.
There's one in a trailer.
So, Vic, you're trying to tell me that you guys didn't play shirtless volleyball? on the beach?
Yeah, we did. We just didn't look that good.
Yeah. Oh boy, that would be fun to watch a military movie with Vic. That would be fantastic.
No, I can't watch him. I just can't.
Yeah.
The Saving Private Ryan was of course I'd never been in battle, but that I didn't really find very many mistakes. I'm sure there are some.
When I've talked to people who served in the military, the one movie that always pops up as being painfully accurate is the first half of Full Metal Jacket.
Oh, yeah.
That's the one that every single person I've ever talked to who served in the military is like, yeah, that's basic training.
From what I've heard about the Marines, I believe that's who they were following,
yeah,
right?
That's the Marines, that's, yeah.
From what I've heard, that's pretty accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, he hired Arlie Ermey. Arlie Ermey wasn't an actor. He was the guy who played the drill instructor. He was a real drill instructor. He was actually the tech advisor on the movie. He was hired to be the tech advisor.
Yeah, I do know him. Yeah.
And then Kubrick was like, why don't you just play the part? Was he nominated for supporting actor for that? I think he was.
I'll see if I could drum it up.
Yeah, and then he got a full career out of it, Arlie Ermey. And a TV show? He was in a ton of movies, including Seven.
Yeah.
Which he's great in. This isn't even my desk. When the phone rings, he picks up the phone. This isn't even my desk. Hangs up the phone.
Drill instructors and training instructors, depending on what branch you're talking about, are very, very similar to what you saw in Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
Regardless of the branch, well, other than Navy, I'm not familiar with what theirs is like, but as far as what they did in the training, there's disparities between the branches on what you do in basic training.
Right.
But they are all very similar to his character in that movie. They're not nice.
Not surprised
not
at all.
Kind at all.
You know what movie I think is probably maybe the most the most accurate armed forces movie of all time? That would be Stripes.
Yeah.
Bill Murray.
I will say he was nominated for the Golden Globe Award for Best Supporting Actor.
So not he wasn't nominated for that.
Not an Oscar. Okay. No.
Boy, that's something. Guy walks on set, drill instructor, gonna be a tech advisor. Suddenly he's in the movie. Had a whole different career. Crazy.
You go through that and you think that you would hate your drill instructor, right? Screaming at you all the time, making you, feel like a maggot, basically.
Yeah.
And when I was in, our training instructor, our TI, got deployed to Iraq, and we were all really kind of sad.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, wow, they do a something. Tough job.
That's something, yeah. All right, well, there you go, everybody. That whole conversation came about because we just played Danger Zone.
That's the magic of Kenny Loggins.
By the bearded one. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. So we're going to talk about 40 A-listers who didn't become famous until after 40. And they say the only thing more inspiring than a great success story is when a great success story that happens later in life. So here are some late bloomers. How about this? Larry David. Even when you look at Larry David from his days on the sketch show Fridays, do you know the show Fridays?
Yeah.
Total absolute ripoff of Saturday Night Live. I watched it, though, every Friday night. It was on ABC on Friday nights. One of the infamous things that happened on that show was when Andy Kaufman was on and he went off script. And Michael Richards, who was a cast member on Fridays, grabbed the cue cards and threw them at him on live TV. Because he ticked off everybody. Well, that's what Andy Kaufman did. But even if you look at those old pictures of Larry David back in the Fridays, that he still looks like he's 70.
Yeah, he's never been a young man.
Never been a young man. Larry David got his start as a writer for Saturday Night Live when he was in his late 30s, but he wasn't exactly successful. As he told Vanity Fair, the sketches would get cut. I only had one sketch in the entire year. Then he turned 42 and he co-created Seinfeld, and the rest is TV history. Yeah, there's some. Do you know that the episode where the episode of Seinfeld where George goes into his boss's office, insults the hell out of him, and says he quits.
Yeah.
And then he walks out, and then he's talking to Jerry, and they decide that he should go back and pretend like it never happened. That's what Larry David did on SNL.
Oh man!
In real life, that's what he did. He screamed at Lorne Michaels, and he quit, and then he came back and acted like it didn't happen. So, yeah. So 42 years old. That's when Seinfeld was created. 42. How about this? Viola Davis is the first black actor to earn the Triple Crown in the acting. She's got an Oscar, an Emmy, and a Tony. Though the first part of her career took place on the stage in the late 2000s and early 2010s, she was in her early 40s, and she made it big in Hollywood with roles in films like Doubt, The Help, and top-billing ABC's How to Get Away with Murder. She solidified herself as a superstar, but it wasn't until she was in her 40s when all that happened. Samuel L. Jackson. Samuel Jackson has been in, like, I don't even, you can't even count how many movies Samuel L. Jackson has been in. According to Box Office Mojo, Samuel L. Jackson's films have grossed more than $7 billion, making him the biggest box office star in Hollywood. Well, listen, Samuel Jackson, you know, one of the biggest box office stars. Listen, when you star in the Star Wars movies and the Marvel movies, you know, you're going to, you know, and The Incredibles. I mean, this, you know, so it's natural to think that he's been on the silver screen. He's been a mainstay since forever. But Jackson didn't score his first big role in Jungle Fever until he was 43. And he didn't score his most famous role as Jules Winfield in Pulp Fiction until he turned 46.
That is wild.
Isn't that nuts? 43 years old in Jungle Fever. He's so good. He and Halle Berry. Halle Berry's great in Jungle Fever. She's great. All right. Let's take a break here for the weather, and then when we come back, we got more people who reached stardom after their 40s. All right. I have no idea what that is. It's Kenny Loggins. I have no idea what that is.
It's also from Top Gun. It's from when they're playing volleyball.
Oh, that's when they're playing volleyball?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't remember.
Playing with the boys.
Oh, all right. He did more than one song for Top Gun?
Yep.
Wow. I know he did more than one song for Caddyshack. Because there was the song that plays during the 15 minutes that the caddies are allowed to use the pool.
Yeah. That was, I believe that one was not actually written solely for Caddyshack, but it was him.
It was used in the movie.
Yeah, it's called Mr. Knight.
That's the name of the song that they played during the right before the Baby Ruth?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Kenny Loggins. Yeah! 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text and for your 2 for Tuesday request. Welcome back, everybody. We're talking about stars that actually really became famous after 40. So, how about this? Melissa McCarthy. Now, see, I know she became like a big star, you know, after Bridesmaids. I realize that. But, man, she's Sookie. She was Sookie on Gilmore Girls for many years. Now, maybe that's not, you know, huge star. Says, you might know the explosively hilarious Melissa McCarthy from films like Identity Thief, The Heat, and Spy. Boy, she'd made some bad movies.
Spy is kind of fun.
I didn't like Spy. I like The Heat, the one with Sandra Bullock.
See, and I didn't like The Heat.
I thought that was very funny. Best thing about Spy is Statham.
He was very
funny. He's hilarious in that movie. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be hilarious in Hobbs and Knobs.
you know that's a... The name of a biscuit, right, is Hobnobs?
Oh, I guess. Yeah.
Like, that's a British biscuit, is Hobnobs.
Well, Hobbs and Knobs.
I can't
If you're a super fan, you know that she had a longtime role on Gilmore Girls, they say. Yeah, no kidding. But it was 2011's Bridesmaids that really catapulted McCarthy into stardom, and she was 41 when it hit screens. Got herself an Oscar nomination. Boy, her new movie looks good, The Kitchen. With her, Tiffany Haddish, and, of course, the extraordinary Elizabeth Moss, who's having an unbelievable year, who, as far as I'm concerned, has given the best performance by any human this year. In my favorite film so far this year, that's Her Smell. She was so amazing in that movie. But, yeah, The Kitchen comes out in August 9th. Looks really good, man. And it takes place in the 70s, so the clothes are going to be fantastic.
Yeah. I like a good mob movie.
Yeah. Oh, Alan Rickman. Oh, man.
Taking farts.
Way to bring me down. Next picture here is Alan Rickman. The late, great Alan Rickman made a name for himself as infamous villains in Die Hard, Robin Hood, and beloved villains in the Harry Potter series, or just plain old jerks in Love Actually. But before Rickman made it on the big screen, he was a graphic designer. Oh. Graphic designer. Did not know that about him. Was Snape really a villain? He turned out not to be. You know?
I found him to still be kind of a creepy dude.
Yeah, well, the hair.
Well, there's that and his general demeanor, but also their version of making him a good guy is being like, oh, yeah, he was super obsessed with your mom.
Yeah.
Till his dying day. And that's kind of weird, man.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever.
Hey, by the way, if you guys want to feel old, speaking of Harry Potter, Daniel Radcliffe turns 30 today. That's just ridiculous. Daniel Radcliffe, 30 years old today. Harry Potter is 30. But anyway, Alan Rickman, he was a graphic designer, and then his first cinematic win was Hans Gruber in Die Hard, and it wasn't until he was 42. And that is the okay, so he was 42 when he got his first movie role. The fact that his first role was Hans Gruber is insane. I mean, completely insane. Like, that's your first role, like, right out of the park? You knock it right out of the park in your first role, like, one of the greatest villains in the history of film? One of the greatest villain performances ever? Hans, Bubby. It's a Rolex. That's the great Hart Bachner. Hart Bachner, man. Fantastic in Breaking Away. He was such a jerk in Breaking Away. He was a good jerk in all of the movies where he played jerks.
Mm-hmm.
Bearded jerk in Die Hard. Also a director. You know what he directed?
Wait, what did he direct?
PCU.
Oh, geez. Of course.
He directed PCU. I think it's a funny movie. I think PCU is a funny movie.
Well, now I can't get that line reading out of my head.
Hans. Bubby. He's great in Die Hard.
Oh, he's a perfect jerk.
Everybody's great in Die Hard. Mm-hmm. All right, how about this? Leslie Jones. Before 2014, Leslie Jones was a relatively unknown stand-up comedian. Then in October of that year, when she was 47, she became a cast member on Saturday Night Live, one of the most beloved to boot. No, she's not beloved. In 2018, she received an Emmy nomination for her work on the show. 47 years old.
What?
When she got hired by Saturday Night Live.
She's... So, is she over 50 now?
Yeah, she's 51.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Hey, don't be, much. I'm 54.
She just doesn't look it.
Yeah.
I mean, neither you do.
Thanks, I appreciate that.
Okay.
Burt Reynolds. The late, great Burt Reynolds. The late Burt Reynolds might have been a major sex symbol, but the great status didn't come until he rounded 40. The Academy Award-nominated actor didn't star in his career-making hits like Deliverance or Smokey the Bandit until he was well into his fifth decade.
Wow.
He was doing TV and stuff when he was when he was younger, and he was doing stunts. He was a stuntman for a very long time.
When was White Lightning then?
73, maybe? 72?
Yeah.
White Lightning, and now Gator was the sequel.
Yeah, Gator's the
sequel. So White Lightning was for a 72, I'm going to say.
Okay.
Connie Britton. Though she had minor roles on TV and film over the years, Connie Britton didn't become a household name until she turned 40 when the first season of Friday Night Lights was launched in 2006. She was also in the 2004 film of the same name. By that time, the series concluded. In 2011, she had received two Emmy nominations for the role.
Spectacular.
Yeah, she's great. Steve Carell. Is this really fair? Because, I mean... Do we count The Daily Show?
I depends on who you're asking. Because I did not know who he was until 40-Year-Old Virgin came out.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
I had no idea he had been on The Daily Show as a correspondent. I did, you know.
It says, today we all know Steve Carell for his 8-year turn as Michael Scott on The Office, but the eventual Oscar nominee... who got his big break in the 2005 comedy, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, didn't book his life-changing sitcom role until he turned 43. So there you go. 43 when he got The Office.
Have you ever seen the commercial that he was in for Brown's Chicken?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He's a local boy.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's not local. I mean, he's not from here. But
he's doing Second City,
He shot that commercial here.
Yeah.
That Brown's commercial. Yeah, he did Second City. Him and Colbert were in the same cast. Martha Stewart. Few public figures are more prolific than Martha Stewart. In addition to writing more than 24 books and headlining the Martha Stewart Show, which came to an end in 2012, she also publishes a magazine, Martha Stewart Living, stars on a hit VH1 show, Martha and Snoop's Potluck Dinner Party. I love that she has teamed up with Snoop Dogg. What's more, she has hosted The Apprentice and has played a role in Law and Order. But she didn't get her start until she was past 40. Her big break was a 1982 book, Entertaining, which hit shelves when she was 41. All right, let's take a break here for the news, shall we? And let's do that right after this. Oh, I love this band. Mr. Sting. And Stuart Copeland and Andy Summers. That would be the Police. Who requested, who's got the great taste in music this morning?
That's coming to us from the 773.
Thank you, 773. Walking on the Moon. They were such a great band.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. And we've been talking about A-listers who actually didn't make it until after 40. Like, they really didn't hit their stride until after 40. And we got some texts here. Jim from Crestwood says, Burt Mustin. Oh, Burt Mustin. Character actor. He didn't start acting until he was in his 60s. Burt Mustin. One of the best. I mean, you, as soon as you see the guy, you know who he is from, like, old sitcoms and stuff. He was one of the best guests on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson ever. He was always hilarious. And you'd know, if you Google Burt Mustin, you go, if you watch any older TV shows or, like, 60s, 70s sitcoms, you know this guy. He was in everything. You look at him, you go, oh, that guy. Didn't start acting until he was in his 60s. And, man, you know, I'm sure you could probably look up his appearances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson on YouTube and do it. Go down that wormhole because he is fantastically entertaining.
Wow, born in 1884.
Lovely man. Really, really lovely man. 630, this is true. Patty says about Phyllis Diller. Phyllis Diller did not get her start until she was, like, I want to say late 40s. And she was a genius, Phyllis Diller. I love Phyllis Diller. Another great guest on The Tonight Show. My husband, Fang. I loved her, man. Loved her. 708 area code says, hey, Nick, Dominic Chase, who was Uncle Junior in The Sopranos, he didn't get started till late. Wait, Jonathan, yeah, you don't, no. Dominic Chase is also, wait a minute, he played Uncle Junior? Yeah, because he's in And Justice for All. He plays one of Al Pacino's clients in And Justice for All. At the beginning of the movie, he gets in the terrible car crash and has a hooker with him in the in the car. He's great in that movie. I love that movie. Have you seen And Justice for All?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I love that movie.
It's very good.
I love that movie. First movie, we can thank Sidney Lumet, who directed that movie. No, I'm sorry. Norman Jewison directed that movie. Norman Jewison. We can thank Norman Jewison for discovering Christine Lotti. That was her first movie. Jeffrey Tambor is in that one.
Craig T. Nelson.
Yeah. Craig T. Nelson, Jeffrey Tambor.
Lee Strasberg.
There's one of my favorite scenes ever. One of my favorite Al Pacino scenes ever is when... at one point, Jeffrey Tambor, like, has a nervous breakdown and goes nuts and starts whipping plates down hallways. And he's shaved his head because he's a defense attorney. And he got this guy off. who was clearly, he was guilty. He was guilty of murder. And he got this guy off on a technicality. And the guy went out and killed a kid. And so Tambor's character kind of loses it. You know what I mean? He feels, obviously feels responsible for getting this guy back out on the street. As a defense attorney, he takes it personally. And he goes nuts. He goes off the deep end, starts flinging plates down the hallway. So they throw him in the back of a of an ambulance. And Al Pacino goes with him. But he gives his another Sam Levine, who plays this other lawyer. He gives Sam Levine this case that he has to skip, and it is this transvestite who is up on charges for robbery, and so he gives, like, Al Pacino gives Sam Levine, the actor, you know, who plays the other lawyer, he's going to take the case, and he does not give the right papers to the judge, and the guy gets sentenced to jail, and then he hangs himself. The guy then hangs himself. So there's a scene in the movie where Pacino confronts Sam Levine and starts beating the crap out of his Cadillac with a briefcase. With a briefcase, shatters the windshield, and goes nuts because his client hung himself. And it's one of my favorite scenes that Al Pacino has ever done. So, other actors and actresses who didn't really get their stardom until after 40, Christoph Waltz. Christoph Waltz was consistently booking roles in German films and on TV shows since the 80s, but the German-Austrian actor didn't enter into the international zeitgeist till he turned 53, when he played Colonel Hans Landa in Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. It was a performance that won him an Academy Award. And didn't he win for Django, too?
Yeah, for... it's Dr. King, or he won Kane
for,
or something.
He won for Inglourious Basterds, and he won for Django.
Yeah.
You know who gives the best performance in Django?
Kerry Washington.
No, she's great. I love Kerry Washington. It's DiCaprio. DiCaprio, he's unbelievable in that movie. He's unbelievable in every movie.
Yeah.
But I loved him in that movie. I thought he was so great.
He did a very, very, very good job.
Yeah.
But although, for in terms of Quentin Tarantino performances, it's Christoph Waltz's Hans Landa.
Of all time?
Of all time.
Oh, man.
He's the only... If they had not found Christoph Waltz, that movie wouldn't have been made.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's great in it. I would have to... If I'm talking performances by, you know, in Tarantino movies, I would have to think about that. I would have to think about it. First of all, I think Brad Pitt's hilarious in Inglourious Basterds. He's unbelievably funny in that movie.
Gorlami.
He's just ridiculous. Here's Larry on WGN. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you doing? How about Abe Vigoda in The Godfather Part 1 and in Buddy Miller?
Right, yeah. That's true. He had to be like in his 50s. When he was in The Godfather. Godfather, first thing he was in, and then obviously he played Fish on Barney Miller,
yes.
And then Fish on the show Fish, the spinoff.
Yeah.
And then he spent all those years with people wondering whether he was still alive.
Yeah. You guys got a great show. We listen to you every morning.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate it, buddy.
Have a good one.
You too. Yeah, Abe Vigoda. You got to love Abe Vigoda.
He's in The Cannonball Run, too.
He is also in Cal and Keenan Good Burger.
Oh, yeah, he is in Good Burger.
Listen, there's a scene. Go to YouTube and just type in Abe Vigoda Good Burger. And I want to play the audio because it's hilarious. While you're doing that, here's Bridget on WGN. Hi, Bridget.
Good morning.
Morning.
Kathy Bates.
Ah, yes. Yeah, she was in her 40s she's got a small part in Men Don't Leave, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. She has a small part in that. But her big break, obviously, was, the big thing was Misery. And she was in her 40s when she made Misery.
Right.
Yeah, terrific actress.
You know, and she's great.
My favorite Kathy Bates performance of all time, and there are a lot to choose from, but my favorite, without question, is Primary Colors. She's unbelievably good in Primary Colors. So
there's one movie I did not see.
Oh, you got to see it. It's great. It's really, really great, Bridget. Hey, thanks for the call.
Hey, sure. Thank you. Hey, bye.
You seen Primary Colors?
I have not.
Oh, Elaine May wrote it. Mike Nichols directed it.
I do love Mike Nichols.
And it's Travolta's best performance, I think. Emma Thompson.
But what about Blowout?
It's well, yeah, Blowout. He's great in Blowout, but but like he's doing a variation. He's what's you know it's based on the campaign trail for Clinton. I mean, the book Primary Colors, written by Anonymous. It's a great movie, and Kathy Bates is amazing in it. So, did you find the audio of Abe Vigoda?
I've almost got it. It's playing an ad.
Oh, you got an ad going. Well, you have to do that nowadays. Everything's got an ad beforehand. But Abe Vigoda was in, of course, the critically acclaimed Good Burger.
A movie I adore.
I do, too. I love
it. It's so funny.
I love it. Yeah, I love it. But, like, Abe Vigoda, the great Abe Vigoda, didn't get his start till he was in his 50s.
You think you can get me to a hospital? I think I broke my ass.
There you go.
Poor Keenan's just basically a kid.
Oh,
he's basically a child in this movie.
Yeah. Oh, it's interesting to go back and look at that Nickelodeon stuff. The Cal and Kim, Keenan stuff is funny. He's now like, you know, the elder statesman of SNL.
Yeah.
Has the longest running cast. He's the longest running cast member.
Mm-hmm.
Beat Tim Meadows.
Mm-hmm.
Daryl Hammond, who still works on the show.
He's the voice
he's,
now.
Yeah, when Don Pardo passed away, the great Don Pardo, who was as much a part of Saturday Night Live as anybody else was. That voice, Don Pardo.
I still think they should have tapped Orion. I'm not kidding. Orion,
he would not do Saturday Night Live.
Oh, come on.
No
for
way.
The prestige.
No way. He's more prestigious than Saturday Night Live. He's
well,
Orion.
They could borrow some prestige.
He's Orion Samuelson, man.
I understand that. They could use someone of his caliber. Daryl Hammond is great, but he's no Orion Samuelson.
Well, no one is Orion Samuelson except Orion Samuelson.
I'm just saying,
am I going to see Orion this morning? Because I'm sticking around for the first hour of Cochran Show.
You'll probably hear Orion.
I'll hear Orion. We'll have to ask him if he would have taken the gig of Saturday Night Live, and I guarantee you'd say no.
I beg to differ. I bet he would have done
all
it.
All right.
He won one session and be done.
Well, you'd have to do it every week. You'd have to be there live.
We could just he does radio every single day of his life.
I know.
What's another thing?
Guy's got a bigger work ethic than somebody in their 20s.
He's amazing.
He's incredible.
I aspire to that.
Oh, he's the best. One of the longest titles in when the world is running down, you get the best of what's still around. The Police rule. That wraps up 2 for Tuesday.
Yeah!
We'll do it again next week. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. We've been talking about celebrities who really didn't become stars until after they hit 40. So that's what we're talking about right now. And we got some texts here. 312 area code, John Houseman and Wilford Brimley. Yeah, he had to be over 40 when he made The Thing,
mm-hmm.
right? Had to be. And he was billed as A. Wilford Brimley.
Not the Wilford Brimley. One of many Brimleys.
But yeah, and it's a little weird because he's mustacheless in The Thing.
Well, when I was told that he was in it, I was just looking for...
The mustache.
I was looking for the diabetes guy.
Right. Diabetes!
Craig Ferguson.
But yeah, and he doesn't have a mustache in it, and he says, "Watch Clark, watch him close. You hear we?"
And there's always that iconic shot of, "Well, can you let me out now?" He's got the noose in the background.
I won't do it. I'm okay now. I want to come back inside. I hear strange things out here. You hear we? Watch Clark and watch him close. You hear we? Doc says, how about Billy Bob Thornton? He was born in 55. Sling Blade was released in 96. I like them French fried potatoes.
Give me some of them French fried potatoes. Uh-huh.
That was a good movie.
Yeah.
All right. Octavia Spencer. Octavia Spencer booked parts in everything from legal dramas like A Time to Kill to superhero flicks like Spider-Man, but her big break came in 2011 when she won an Oscar for her role in The Help at the age of 41. All right. Ricky Gervais, one of my favorite people who walks this earth, is Ricky Gervais. I adore Ricky Gervais. Greatest laugh in the history of laughs. And that, I got to say, man, when HBO was showing the animated versions of his podcast with Pilkington, it was the funniest show I've ever seen in my life. Those podcasts are Carl Pilkington, man. Idiot Abroad. Then he teams him up with Warwick Davis for one a season. Life is short.
Yeah,
brilliant. And of course, the Liam Neeson scene is one of the greatest comedic scenes of all time.
I would like to do some improvisational acting.
I'm sorry, we're closed.
I'm riddled with it.
I'm riddled. Just as the U.S. version of The Office launched Steve Carell's post-40 career, the U.K. version did the same for Ricky Gervais, and it premiered when he was 40.
I really wish some of his movies had gotten better play, because The Invention of Lying is
amazing movie.
Heartbreaking.
It's a beautiful movie. Beautiful movie.
Mm-hmm.
The Invention of Lying is great. Jeez, what are some of the other ones?
Was it Ghost Town?
Ghost Town was great.
I thought it was good. I didn't like it nearly as much as The Invention of Lying.
Well, The Invention of Lying is it's really sad that movie didn't get the attention that it deserved, because it's a really beautiful movie.
And I was shocked by it. I really thought it was going to be a total schlock fest. I was like, wow, this is poignant. It's really funny, too.
How about this? Ty Burrell made himself a name in theater as a Shakespearean actor who had roles in Coriolanus, Twelfth Night, the Scottish play, which I will not say. As You Like It in Henry V, but he became a household name with the role of Phil Dunphy on Modern Family at the age of 42. Well, now, wait a minute now. Dawn of the Dead, man.
Yeah, as the biggest jerk.
He's spectacular in Dawn of the Dead.
I just felt, once I saw Modern Family and I watched Dawn of the Dead again, I realized he was in it. I was like, no, Phil. Yeah.
No, he's great in Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
He's great.
Very slimy.
Man. John Mahoney.
Yeah.
John Mahoney was already 47 when he was most promising male newcomer at Broadway from his Broadway peers. While theater fans were familiar with his work, he wouldn't become a household name until he joined Frasier in 87, taking the role of Frasier's dad, Martin Crane. He was 53. So, 87, really? Wow. So, yeah, John Mahoney. I'm incarcerated, Lloyd! Jane Lynch, another Chicagoan.
Yep.
Jane Lynch, 43. She landed her first big gig in Christopher Guest's Best in Show and later gained even more familiar side-splitting roles. And she's hilarious in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Oh, my God, is she funny. She was 45 when she made that. And then she's best known as Sue Sylvester on Glee. She won an Emmy, a Golden Globe, and a SAG Award. She's great on that show.
My favorite role of hers is Role Models.
She's fantastic in Role Models.
You'll be in the slammer,
yeah,
like MC Hammer. Did MC Hammer go to jail? No, but he came very close.
Yeah. A woefully underrated movie. She was great on Glee, and that's a show that I continued to watch when everybody when everybody stopped. I was still on the Glee train well after people were like, "Do you still watch Glee?"
The whole thing with her, and it was her younger sister, right?
Yeah,
it was just so beautifully played.
Yeah,
it was so great.
How about Regis Philbin? Regis Philbin he was an announcer. He did all kinds of stuff. He was a sidekick. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until he was 57 when he got live with Regis and Kelly Lee. Kelly Lee. That's what David Letterman used to call
Kelly Lee?
Kelly Lee. On purpose.
Well, now it's her and who? She.
Seacrest.
Really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Seacrest. It's her it's Kelly and Seacrest, yeah.
Oh, wow.
One of Brian Seacrest's 97 jobs.
Yeah.
Joy Behar. She taught English in high school, but in 1997, when she was 55, she joined The View. Well, she was a stand-up for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick Stewart kicked off his career on the British stage, but he didn't get his first major TV gig on Star Trek Next Generation until he was in his 40s.
And now he's back.
I love that guy.
Yeah. Picard. He's going back to the old Army uniform.
Judi Dench became famous on stage. Well, she had a long career on stage, and she did a couple of movies here and there. But now they're saying that she didn't become a household name until she played M in GoldenEye, and that was when she was 61.
I mean, they're not wrong.
Yeah, but she's Judi Dench, man.
Yeah, of course. Of course, I know.
Tommy Lee Jones. He was in a ton of movies before The Fugitive. They're saying that The Fugitive was he was 47. Tommy Lee Jones was in a ton of movies when he was younger.
Famous?
He didn't become like a household name.
He was that guy probably The Fugitive. And then it was like, wait, who's this dude?
Before Bryan Cranston was Walter White, he was Malcolm's dad, Hal on Malcolm in the Middle. But even with that breakout role, didn't come till he was 44. What about Tim Watley? Dentist to the Stars. Rodney Dangerfield.
Yeah.
In the 1950s, the late Rodney Dangerfield worked as an aluminum siding salesman, and in 1967, he gave stand-up a shot. After booking an episode on The Ed Sullivan Show, he became an overnight sensation at the age of 46.
Can you imagine that guy trying to sell you aluminum siding?
Kim Cattrall. What? Booked pretty impressive parts in the 80s, including Police Academy, Big Trouble in Little China, and Mannequin. Her biggest role, however, was as Samantha Jones on Sex and the City. It happened in 1998 when she was 42 years old. Come on, man. Kim Cattrall was in Porky's, for God's sake. And Big Trouble in Little China. Come on.
I feel like there was another one from before Sex and the City that was really good. She had a really good role, but it's not Big Trouble. I don't know.
Yeah. All right, and then finally, Leslie Nielsen. He didn't get he didn't get Airplane until he was 42 years old. So there you go. All right, we got a break here, but coming up on tomorrow, we're going to talk tech with CNET's Ian Schur. We got Know Your Onion, and it'll be Wildcard Wednesday and more. Let's take a break here. The news is coming up right after this.